Good Wednesday to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of Cam and Company right here on NRA-TV, SiriusXM Patriot 125, and more. Fueled, as always, by Hornady, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, coming to you once again from beautiful downtown Farmville, Virginia today. It is the day after Election Day in Virginia, and not a good night for gun owners across the state of Virginia. We're going to talk about this throughout the afternoon. Coming up about 20 minutes from now, Jazz Shaw of Hot Air joins us on the program. A couple of pieces we'll talk about with Jazz, but the thing that really caught my eye that Jazz has written at Hot Air today, nobody likes the Democrats, he says, but the Republicans and the media can't brag either. A lot of bragging going on here, particularly regarding the results in Virginia, where it was a wave election for Democrats last night. We'll talk about this with Jazz Shaw. Adam Sabas of Campus Reform on the college professor who regrets now tweeting that the GOP and the NRA, quote, want mass shootings. Glad to see this professor has had a change of heart. We'll talk with Adam about it coming up a little bit later on in the hour. Christopher Nyweim of the Nyweim Group says our gun control debate in the United States needs a hard reset. Don't know how likely it is that we're going to get that, but we'll find out what that hard reset would look like, according to Chris. Coming up next hour, Robert Trusinski at The Federalist, wondering why won't the nightmare dream of communism die? 100 years after the start of the Russian Revolution, Virginia elected a democratic socialist, Cameron. How about that? Hashtag progress. Hashtag Goochland Gulag. I don't know if that's really going to be a thing. I imagine the gulags would probably be more southwest Virginia, more Wise County, something like that. Sorry, Cameron, I don't mean to make you choke on your lunch there. I apologize.
It's all right. There was a lot of choking last night.
There was a lot. A lot of choking, yeah. Jesse Jane Duff going to join us in hour three, talking about a story Stars and Stripes reporting that the military and the Pentagon has been aware of the non-reporting of disqualifying crimes to the National Crime Center, the National Instant Check System, not just for a matter of months or a couple of years. No. Stars and Stripes reporting that the Pentagon has known for at least 20 years, at least two decades, about failures to give military criminal history information to the FBI, including the type of information that the Air Force did not report about the killer in Texas who had previously assaulted his wife and stepson while an airman. And again, this arrest report from El Paso in 2012 coming out yesterday indicating that those were the charges that ultimately he was sentenced to a year in confinement for. But there were other allegations that he had made threats against his commanding officers, that he had tried to bring firearms onto base unauthorized. Those charges, again, apparently dropped as Stars and Stripes reports in 2012. In addition to his conviction in the domestic violence case, Kelly had escaped from a mental health center. Air Force says federal privacy laws prohibited it from commenting on the report. Representative Mac Thornberry, Texas Republican chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, said, quote, I don't believe the Air Force should be left to self-police after such tragic consequences, adding that he fears that the failure to report domestic violence convictions may be more widespread. So we'll talk about this with Jesse Jane Duff of the London Center for Policy Research coming up in hour three. Also, Stephen Cruiser of PJ Media coming up in hour three. But before we get into any of that, let's... Excuse me. Let's talk about the choke last night. Let's talk about the elections, particularly in Virginia, although I do want to talk about the anti-gun agenda that Phil Murphy, the governor-elect in New Jersey, has laid out. And it is a doozy. So get ready, New Jersey gun owners. In Virginia, first of all, so the gun vote and the gun owner vote. I'm looking here at the exit polling from yesterday. So, again, this is not a perfect snapshot, okay? Please don't think that the exit polling yesterday is, you know, hard scientific data that measures down to the granular level what the electorate in Virginia looked like yesterday. I think it's fair to call it a rough estimate. So according to the exit polls, 52% of voters yesterday were from gun-owning households. Majority of voters yesterday were from gun-owning households. And a majority of those voters voted for Ed Gillespie. 61% voting for Ed Gillespie, 2% voting for Cliff Hyra, the Libertarian candidate who at some point I'm inevitably going to call Cliff Hydra. I apologize in advance for that. And 37% of voters in households with firearms voted for Ralph Northam, according to the exit polling. 48% of the Virginia electorate yesterday, according to these exit polls, did not have a firearm in their home. Ralph Northam got 73% of that vote. Ed Gillespie, 26%. Cliff Hyra, 1%. Now, how does this compare to 2016? In 2016, Hillary Clinton got 36% of the vote of households in which there is a firearm. Donald Trump got 59%. So Gillespie actually outperformed Trump, according to the exit poll, by a couple of points. Northam outperformed Clinton by a point. Fairly similar results. As far as the non-gun-owning households, in November 2016 in Virginia, Clinton got 68% of that vote. Donald Trump got 28%. So among the non-gun-owning households, you saw a shift of about 5 points towards Clinton and about 2 points away from Gillespie compared to Trump. So 52% of the Virginia electorate yesterday live in a – they might not be gun owners themselves. Might be their spouse. Might be a parent. But they live in a home in which there is a firearm. And yet, just 61%, let's say roughly 60%, of those voters cast their vote for a pro-gun candidate. Down ticket, you saw a 17-seat advantage. Well, more than 17-seat advantage, but Democrats had to pick up 17 seats in the 100-member House of Delegates in order to take back a majority. Republicans were really pretty close to a supermajority. That's gone now. The last I saw, 50-50. And there might be some races where you will have recounts because a lot of these races were very close. Northern Virginia turned out big time. There was, and everybody today is trying to assess, okay, well, what does this mean, right? What drove this? And I think that there are probably – Virginia is a big state, first of all. Cameron knows this because he's driven from Northern Virginia down to Bristol, Virginia. It's a big state.
It's a very big state. And it's right? until you travel it, you really don't know. Listen, we're not Texas, but it takes a long time to get from one end to the other.
Yeah, absolutely. So to say that there's one answer, one reason, there's not. Because in many ways, there's more than one Virginia. Northern Virginia, I think it's evident. I think I'm going out on a fairly sturdy limb here to say that, there was a strong vote against Donald Trump, not necessarily against Ed Gillespie. This was a motivating factor, driving people to the polls, particularly in Northern Virginia, which has gone bluer. Cameron talks about living in Alexandria, which has been deep indigo for quite some time, along with Arlington County. They had huge turnout. A lot of these individuals either work for the government directly, might have a spouse that's employed by the government, work as a government contractor. But they're part of the D.C. infrastructure. And as D.C. has expanded and the size of government has expanded, the D.C. Metroplex has expanded as well. So when I moved to the Northern Virginia area in 2004, I moved to Western Fairfax County, about 20 miles away from Washington, D.C. And it was, at that point, considered a quote-unquote purple county. But the counties further to the west of Fairfax County, Prince William County, where Manassas, Virginia is located, Loudoun County up to the northwest, where Leesburg is, those were considered the exurbs of Washington, D.C. You just were starting to have, like, D.C. workers moving into that area because it was affordable, at least more affordable than moving in closer to Washington, D.C. Those were still generally seen as fairly reliably conservative seats, fairly reliably red. The closer you got to D.C., the bluer it got. Well, last night, you had a legislative race, district basically Loudoun County. The Democrat there won by 20 points in Loudoun County, which is, if you are a Northern Virginia resident or you follow Virginia politics, like, that's a shocking result. A lot of these races were, again, very close. That one wasn't. And at least as of the map, the last night's map, the blue D.C. burbs have expanded southward, probably another good 30, 45 miles down to Fredericksburg, Virginia, Stafford County. The blue areas have shifted west into Loudoun County, even down towards Warrenton, Fauquier County. I mean, these are places that just weren't competitive, and now they are. But this was, again, something that we had talked about with Andrew Langer yesterday. Democrats said, we're going to run candidates in districts where haven't run candidates in years and multiple election cycles. And we're going to see what happens. There were a lot of races, a lot of districts in the state of Virginia. The Republicans did not contest. There were still some districts, by the way, where it was only the Republican on the ballot. And you still saw that for the Democrats as well. But Northern Virginia and the surge in voting in Northern Virginia, coupled with, I got to say, and I hate to say it, I think a complacency. I don't want to call it apathy, because I don't quite think that's the right word. But I think it is complacency. Particularly, again, if you live in a place where you've been, you know, represented by the same representative or the same party for 15, 20 years. You may think, no big worries here, right? I know how this is going to turn out. It's going to turn out the way it's always turned out. You look at the level of support that Ed Gillespie got in a lot of counties in rural Virginia, and it wasn't that he lost those counties. I mean, in some cases, he'd win counties 75-25, but the level of turnout was stagnant or down compared to 2016. You know, I think maybe the easiest way to describe what happened last night is that a lot of Democrats treated this like it was a presidential election, and a lot of Republicans treated it like it was an off-year election for governor. And the voter turnout on the Republican side more reflective of what a typical off-year election would look like. But again, in Northern Virginia, places like Charlottesville, where I think voter turnout was up 31% over 2013, this was viewed as a must-vote, must-win election. So I got to tell you what I'm taking from this. First of all, looking forward here to 2018, as gun owners, I think we have to, first of all, engage other gun owners. And this is something that we had talked about over the last couple of weeks. I'm kicking myself for not doing more. And I plan on doing more. But, you know, 37% in Virginia of households with firearms voting for the most anti-gun candidate. That's pretty troubling. Healthcare, according to this exit poll, the number one issue in Virginia in this election. Gun policy, according to the exit polls, the number two issue number one issue for 17% of Virginia voters, about one in seven. And according to this exit poll, about 49% of those voters who said that gun control was their big issue or gun policy was their big issue voted for Ralph Northam. 49% voted for Ed Gillespie. 2% voted for the Libertarian Cliff Hira. So there is outreach that we can be doing to non-gun owners and engaging in with non-gun owners, but there's a lot of outreach that we need to be doing with gun owners as well. And unfortunately, this is a rough lesson. You know, nothing shakes you from your complacency like all of a sudden having to deal with the repercussions of your complacency, right? And I have a feeling that Virginia gun owners are going to be dealing with some repercussions for their complacency in the months and years to come. Now, New Jersey, I have not forgotten you, and we will not forget you, New Jersey gun owners. I promise you that. Coming up top of the hour, since we talked about Virginia, top of this hour, top of next hour, we're going to talk about New Jersey. And we're going to talk about Governor Phil Murphy, Governor-elect Phil Murphy, and what he has already said he wants to do with New Jersey's gun laws and to New Jersey's gun owners. But we'll do that coming up top of the hour when we come back after a quick timeout. Jas Shah from Hot Air. You know, as this wave election happened in Virginia, CNN comes out with a poll showing that the approval rating for Democrats, lowest recorded in history of this poll anyway. Again, you'd think that might be an incongruous result, but as it turns out, Republicans aren't polling any better. And neither are the media, by the way. So who do we like these days? We'll talk about it with Jas Shah of Hot Air coming up right after this. Stick around, just getting started here on this Wednesday edition of Cam and Company.
Here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin for the NRA Carry Guard Expo, here's Cody St. John, who is with Diamondback Firearms. Talk about your firearm.
Yes, sir. Well, we first came out with a 380. You know, the 380 became popular, so we, you know, we kind of wanted to give what the people wanted. Mm-hmm. So we came out with a 380. The Diamondback 380, a striker fire, no safety, you know, single stack. It has a nice safety feature. Striker fire, the firing pin's not in a locked position. You have to worry about slipping off or anything like that. Firing pin block. So that became popular, and then we wanted to take on this feat of coming out with a 9. Okay. So now we have the smallest, lightest 9mm single stack striker fire. It's right here. And this became very popular. This is the smallest and lightest 9 that you can find. So if you want to make sure that you leave the house with a firearm, that's the gun. Okay. So whether you're wearing jeans, shorts, that's going to be perfect for you. You know what I mean? Now, this right here, we're just about to release this. This is just a basically almost in the works. It's a prototype grip here, but we're coming out with the AM2. It's a subcompact. Everybody's been asking for it, and it's going to be a little modular. You're going to be able to change out grips in the future, stuff like that. It's going to have the option for night sights, and it'll come with a 10-round, mm-hmm. and it'll also come right with a 15. And there you go. So you're going to – Diamondback is going to have everything covered from 380, full-size, smallest and lightest 9s, and we even deal with ARs.
Oh, wow. Sure.
So we're releasing the 6.5 Creedmoor to, like, right now, and we have a 308 pistol as well, 13.5-inch barrel. And I'm very excited about that.
That's awesome. Well, in addition to your great firearms, I got to say you have a great shirt. We make S-word that goes bang. We can't say the S-word, but that's a great shirt.
And, we actually sold out of it. And
I bet you did.
I mean, you can find them on our website still, and it's a very popular shirt. Nine Line was nice enough to make that shirt for us, so I give them credit for that.
Cool. What's the website?
DiamondbackFirearms.com. I'm very excited about this show. It's nice seeing the people, talking to them, and seeing the families that come up here. The families is where it's at, and letting them, you know, come over here with their kids and teaching them, hey, don't touch this, don't do that. And then even people coming up saying the gun's too small. But then talking to them, it's like, well, if it's too small, you know, you're not going to be able to fit it in your pocket, right? Now we're getting the guns in their pocket because now they're going to have a gun with them at all times. They can protect themselves and their family.
Every animal that has ever roamed this planet was designed as hunted or hunter, predator or prey. We are hunters. If it were ever necessary, even the strictest vegan would return to the wild, driven to survive by the instincts of his ancestors. Those who hide behind the soft delusion of their own ignorance Do so from within a civilization whose very being costs the lives of countless creatures every single day. Death is an undeniable fuel of life. This is the undeniable truth of existence. To live in balance with the planet that sustains us, we must admit and embrace the nature within us. Trust the hunter in your blood.
My mission in life is to set a new standard by educating, training, and equipping my fellow warriors and citizens to become assets to themselves, their families, and this country. This mindset has led me on a path to become a self-protection expert, and I'm excited to share some of my knowledge with you guys. On this season of Noir, I'll be showcasing some of the best in self-defense, and I'll be showing my techniques in super slow motion. Over the next few months, NRA TV will be releasing a constant stream of interviews, scenarios, and techniques in slow motion. Get ready, guys, because this is going to be a whole new way for you to engage and become an asset.
Welcome back to Cam and Company right here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125 and more. Adam Sabas of Campus Reform join us a little bit later on in the program. Jazz Shah of Hot Air with us on the show right now. Jazz, how are you, sir?
I am just fine and dandy, my friend. It's a tremendous Wednesday.
Well, good for you. We're still smarting a little bit here in Virginia from the election results last night, but I'm glad you're smiling. That's good.
Well, I guess at the moment I'm also smiling because I don't live in Virginia.
Yeah, you know, listen, Virginia, I'm starting to feel a little bit more like downstate New York, New York South here, looking at the election results last night, and I might be calling you for advice here on how to live in a anti-gun state here before long. But you've got a piece at Hot Air that I think is well worth checking out. You know, this was a wave election in Virginia last night. I don't think any pundit saw the legislative races in Virginia turning out the way they did. And as you say, despite all those champagne corks popping for Virginia and New Jersey, you say the latest polling from CNN may give them pause to reconsider, right? This new poll shows that the Democratic Party's approval ratings have dropped to their lowest mark in, what, 25 years?
Yeah, pretty most of the history of the poll. In fact, they're used to floating a bit above 40, even in bad times. But now they've dropped down in the mid to upper 30s, which puts them still ahead of the GOP, who are used to being more in the low to mid 30s.
Mm-hmm.
But we seem to be approaching parity, that people are not really tremendously enamored of the Democrats, even if they're voting for them. And one of the sub questions in the crosstabs on that poll, I think, really was borne out by what we saw more so in Virginia than New Jersey, which is a pretty blue state. And Chris Christie was sort of an aberration there. But the larger number of people who were going to vote Democrat were not doing so because they were excited about their own party. They responded saying that the majority of the reason they were supporting them was because they just really didn't like the other party.
Yeah, and in Virginia, based on the exit polls that I saw, and again, not a perfect snapshot, but I think they said about, I think it was like a third of the electorate had said that they were casting their vote not for a candidate, but against Donald Trump, right? So a third of Northam's voters said that was their primary reason. They weren't voting for the guy, but they were voting against a guy who wasn't even on the ballot. This, as you say, a little bit different because it's asking about the party, and are you voting in support of a party or just against the other one? But as you say, you know, look, the numbers are bad for Democrats. The numbers are bad for Republicans, and the numbers are bad for the media too, Jazz, which I thought was not surprising, but it's kind of interesting that that was actually polled along with political parties.
Right. I know there were a lot of us who probably weren't surprised at that, people who follow, who basically live and breathe and eat politics on mm-hmm. a daily basis and sort of exist by, you know, soaking our feet in the swamp and getting covered with the mold and whatnot. So a lot of us probably were distrustful. I that seems to have spread out across the country to people who, now that, you know, after the November election is over, people who generally go back to watching football, you know, or whatever sport they follow or reality TV and try to get on with their lives and not, and are just grateful not to be barraged with advertisements all the time. But even they, you cannot find a majority anywhere that considers the three alphabet networks, the major cable news networks, or the three biggest newspapers, the Washington Post, the New York Times, and the LA Times, as being trustworthy. Nobody, there is no majority that applies the word trustworthy to those news sources.
Yeah, as you say, like, I mean, the most generous assessment would be 48% of those surveyed said that they found those media outlets trustworthy, but only 17% felt that the media is, quote, very trustworthy, right? 28% of those folks said, well, they're somewhat trustworthy. They still take their news with plenty of grains of salt. So you've got less than one in five Americans, according to this poll, who believe that the news media is, quote, unquote, very trustworthy. And yet, Jazz, I mean, I assume these are not all uninformed boobs. Where are they getting their news from, I wonder?
I think that's where they are getting their news. They're just, one would hope, being a bit more selective about it, looking at multiple sources, doing more checking. That's the hope, anyway, because I want to get back to what you said, that there is a big distinction when you're talking about the media about the phrase somewhat trustworthy or relatively or whatever and very trustworthy. Politicians, I think anybody could look at politicians, at political parties, and go, well, that one's probably more trustworthy than the other one, in my opinion, depending which side of the line you're on. But come on, they're still politicians.
Mm-hmm.
This is talking about an institution, the Fourth Estate, which in theory is supposed to be the watchdog. They're supposed to be doing the work that you yourself can't do, diving into the cracks, digging the information. And of course, they do a lot of digging, a lot of diving. Some of it might be dumpster diving, and they are getting information. But the way they portray it, and not so much always inaccuracies or, dare I use the word, lies, or at least gross mistakes, but putting spin on things, focusing more on some stories than others, the language they use. So how do people not pick up on that eventually? No matter what your pet issue is or pet issues are, you get this information being fed to you if you're watching the news even just once a day, picking up one newspaper or looking at that newspaper's website online. You see the language. You get the tone. And you see the disputes if you flip over to another competing station saying, no, that's not right, or that's really misdirection. That's going to raise questions in an institution that in an ideal world, and I'm not saying it ever really was this way, in an ideal world, they would be very trustworthy for everyone, because that's, you know, that's the temple. That's where you're going to get your information, and they're going to hold the scoundrels accountable and, you know, bring all that's in the darkness to light, you know. But no, I think they've done it to themselves, and now people just don't trust them either.
So who do we trust these days, Jazz?
Well, I pulled up one more survey in that article that you mentioned, and I went to look at the annual Pew survey of trust in institutions.
Okay.
And I only managed to find three institutions in American society that receive a majority of people saying that they place their trust in them. And those are, in order of least to highest in terms of the most trust, the police, which unfortunately is much lower than I would like to see it, but it's still a majority. It's above 50. And then we have small business, which comes in at around 70%. And the institution most trusted by the American people is the military.
at 72%, right?
Yes. So, which is not too bad.
That is, all things considered, no. So, as you write, in theory, the civilian government is supposed to be completely in charge, be able to keep the military in check so we don't fall under a coup. But at this point, the populace places far more trust in the military than our civilian leadership. Sleep well, citizens. Now, listen, I know you're being a little sarcastic here, but it is...
I was.
It's not just worth pointing out. It's actually worth spending some time on. I mean, these 14 institutions that Gallup surveyed, again, we're talking about the Supreme Court, legislative branch, executive branch, big business, healthcare, all of these parts of our civic and our civil life. There are only three areas where we, actually trust folks. We trust small businesses because, again, you're talking and interacting with the owner. We trust the military because we believe that these are folks who are sacrificing, to protect our country. And, 57% say that they trust the police. Other than that, we don't trust anybody. We don't have a lot of faith. You wonder if we're becoming a nation of cynics. I almost wonder, Jazz, if we've, blown past cynicism and we're coming up on the exit for nihilism here.
I have to hope it's not gone that far. I think a lot of these institutions have given us fair reason to raise questions at a minimum, to not just blindly put our trust in things.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, part of it might be the fact that you get let down by a few people so often, like banking. People don't trust the banks anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They don't believe they're being dealt with fairly. The banks rate pretty darn low. But we had some headlines about the really big investment bankers either letting things slip up like Wells Fargo and, secret accounts being created. You get a few scandals like the folks from Enron and other people who were running scams and taking care of their friends and screwing over. But it just seems to me there are still a lot of banks out there, particularly relate that to the small business question, like local credit unions, things like that. Where you can go and, they do the job they're supposed to do and they don't do anything nefarious. And, you go and you show up at the machine and your money's there. You put money into a savings account and they keep it for you. And I think we could be a lot more trusting so long as we are careful and are judicious in where we place our trust. So I don't think it's full-blown nihilism yet. And I think there is more reason for optimism than those numbers really suggest, at least in some areas.
All right. Jazz Shaw with Hot Air. Look at you taking the role of sunny optimist today. Usually that's my job when we're talking, but good for you. Good to switch it up a little bit.
Well, it's Friday for me because I'm the weekend editor, and I'm always in a better mood on Wednesdays.
Hey, by the way, before we let you go, and I apologize to the audience for taking up time here, but I have a horseradish-related question for you.
Sure.
Okay. So the goats, we had covered up the horseradish plants, so we thought the goats couldn't get to them. Well, we were wrong. And there are still like a little bit of green leaves there, but the goats have nibbled most of the leaves. Is this thing going to come back, you think, given that it's already November and I was thinking that it was dying anyway? Is it going to come back in the spring?
How big were the leaves? Did you just have little starter shoots that were only like 6 inches high, or did you have bushes?
No, we had some pretty good sized bushes.
Oh, then you're good.
Okay.
Go stick your finger down by the base of one of the sets of stalks, and if you see a root at the base of any of them that's more than, say, 3/4 of an inch diameter at the top, and some of them can get up to a couple of inches once you've had the bed going for a few years. If you see some half-inch, three-quarter-inch roots, that means that they are buried down there a good 3 to 4 feet already. So you can go through right now and just cut them down to the quick, which is what I did to all of mine. There's bare dirt in my beds right now. And in the spring, my friend, the horseradish will rise up, and it will rise up faster and sooner than all the other plants around it and cut off the sunlight to them, and it will kill everything else off.
All right, you made me feel much better. Jazz Shaw from Hot Air here with the latest news and all of your gardening needs. Jazz, thank you, sir. I appreciate it. We'll talk again soon.
Take care, Cam.
All right, you too, sir. Jazz Shaw with us here on Hot Air. Before we take a break, there's one interesting note about the Gallup survey of trust in institutions. that Jazz had mentioned. Because as I'm going through this, they have actually been asking questions about how much you trust you place in these various institutions. Going back to 1973, and there are some institutions where you can clearly see an erosion in public trust. For example, the church or organized religion. In 1973, 65% of Americans said they had a great deal or somewhat trusted organized religion. By 2017, that was down to 41%. And it had dipped below 50% for the first time in 2002, kind of settled below 50% about 2010, and has been gradually dropping. Then you look at an institution like Congress. 2017, 12% of Americans said they had a great deal or quite a lot of confidence and trust in Congress. That's low, but it's been under 20% since 2006. Throughout most of the 2000s and in the 90s, you're looking at 25 to 30% trust in Congress. But go back to, 93, 18%. You've really got to go back to like the 1970s to find a level of trust in the in Congress going up to 40%. But again, we've seen a gradual decline. Organized labor, 2017, 28% of Americans surveyed had a great deal or quite a lot of trust in organized labor, compared to 30% in 1973. Hasn't been much change over the decades when it comes to Americans' trust in organized labor. Big business, 21%, a great deal of trust, quite a lot of trust in big business in 2017. That is fairly static. I think the highest level of support that, quote-unquote, big business has enjoyed going back to 1973 was in 1975, when 34% of Americans said they had quite a bit or a great deal of trust in big business. Public schools, yeah, you've seen a pretty big erosion. I mean, 1973, 58%, great deal, a lot of trust. Even as recently as 1987, 50%. But by like 1994, 34% of Americans have a great deal or quite a lot of trust in public schools. It's at 36% in 2017. You know, it is worth looking at these trends because, again, some of these institutions we really have seen an erosion. Other institutions we just haven't placed a lot of trust in from the get-go. But to kind of look and pinpoint when that erosion in trust started and really to see how long we've been going without a lot of trust in these institutions does kind of make you wonder. Again, if we are turning into a nation of cynics or I don't know if there's some sunny optimism right around the corner. Now, when we come back, we're going to talk with Adam Sabas, of a campus reform, about a college professor who is now regretting their tweet claiming that Republicans, NRA members, want mass murder. Stick around. We've got more Cam and Company coming up next.
I am here with Eric Lipp with the NRA Eddie Eagle Gun Safe Program. I always love talking about Eddie, and Eddie is representing today. He not only is here, he's got his cool shades and the whole nine yards. So let's talk about what is the Eddie Eagle Gun Safe Program.
It's very simple and straightforward. It's a firearm accident prevention program for young kids. Everything centers around Eddie's very important message. If you see a gun, stop, don't touch, run away, tell a grown-up. We work with kids pre-K through fourth grade, and we try to get that message out to communities in very many ways.
So how did Eddie Eagle come about? And let's talk a little bit about the history, because Eddie Eagle has taught, 29, the message got out to 29 million kids?
Yeah, we're over 29. We're real close to knocking on that 30 million doorstep.
And how long has the program been around for?
29 years.
29 years. So
we're
knocking on
about
30
million kids a year.
And 30 years. It's a great, rich history. So how did it all start?
So it started off with, the need for safety. We realized that there wasn't anything out there to address child or children and firearms, and the NRA saw that need. And as with many things in safety and firearms, we decided to fill that void. So we used curriculum specialists, school people, law enforcement agencies, firearm instructors from our own organization, and we put all those heads together and came up with this great program.
It is a great program, and sometimes there's pushback from some people. It's like, well, this is the NRA. Why should we do this? And you got a pretty straightforward answer for that.
Yeah, I think we can all agree that teaching safety to kids is important. We're not here to talk about the NRA when we talk Eddie Eagle to schools and kids. It's not on our integrated materials other than the little tiny copyright mark that is kind of forced upon us. But, yeah, it's not there to talk about the NRA. We don't talk about whether guns are good or bad, just that they might be around some households, that whether it's your own household or households that you may visit. And just like any other message, you're going to teach your kids not to talk to strangers, not to play with matches. It's another same deal.
It's common sense. Education.
That's the biggest word. You know, we don't get much argue back. Once you look at our materials, it's right. Hard to argue with. It's common sense.
All right, so let's talk about those materials. Talk with Eric Lipp, by the way, with the Eddie Eagle Gun Safe Program. So Eddie has recently gotten a wonderful kind of a little facelift, and he's now online.
Yep.
And tell us a little bit about getting to those web assets, and then you have some other ways you can get Eddie
Absolutely.
Stuff, too.
So, you know, we have a long, rich history. Like we said, we've always had a workbook for kids. It goes along with a sticker, and then usually some information for parents because, you know, first and foremost, we want parents to talk to their own kids. You know, this is an important issue, and just like anything else, we want parents involved. So we've had these traditional materials for a long time. Like you said, we got a new face look, lift for Eddie. He's got a new cast of friends.
Yeah.
They have his own little neighborhood park and everything. And they're out there trying to teach other kids and learn the right message.
Yeah, it's a great video, by the way. You go to the website. Tell them the website. But you and I were talking before the interview.
Yep.
Watch it a bunch of times. He's got a
catchy,
cool little cast of friends. You know.
Yep. So yeah, we created in the past 2 years EddieEagle.com. Houses our video, but in addition to our video, we have some storybooks for kids to go through. We got a safety quiz for them to take. There's coloring activity pages, and it's really made for a family to use together. So you can go on there with your child, watch the movie, take the quiz, and then continue that education through storybooks and other things that we found a lot of kids are really, really enjoying. It's one of those things that, like, it's almost like every night before bed, what story are we going to do?
Yeah.
So we're real proud of what we got out there. But like you said, we also do have the regular movie. When a school calls us, for example, you know, we supply them with a movie for the school to keep at the school library. And then we got great workbooks for each kid. So, you know, we try to give them a workbook for each child, parents' information to go home with that child, and then student instructor information for the teachers.
And the parents from the main page have a place they can go for the parents-only part,
Absolutely,
right?
Yep. There's a parents tab. They can go in. They can learn information, some tips about talking to your own kids. Tips for talking to other parents. You know, what do your neighbors have in their houses? You want to make sure you're safe, your kids are safe with going to other places' houses, and that's why you want to focus on education.
Eddie Eagle Gun Safe Program, a great part of the community. Tell folks how they can get more information again about Eddie.
Super, super easy. Go to EddieEagle.com. The video's there. Everything for kids is available. There's also a tab for grown-ups that we mentioned. So if you click on that, it'll give you all the resources for parents. And then at that point, they'll even give you a contact page. So if you really want to contact us at headquarters, we can give you whatever you need.
Awesome. Eric Lipp, NRA Eddie Eagle Gun Safe Program. Thanks for what you do, and thanks for being on the program.
Thanks for having us. We love being here.
Welcome back to Cam and Company right here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125 and more. We've got next hour Christopher Nyweim of the Nyweim Group, who says U.S. gun control, the debate needs a hard reset. Also, Robert Trusinski of the Federalist wondering why won't the nightmare dream of communism die 100 years after the Russian Revolution unleashed communism and a communist state on the world. Yeah, we still got it. And we've got others. I actually want to bring it here to the United States. Right now, I want to welcome from Campus Reform, Adam Sabas is with us. Adam, how are you, sir?
I'm doing pretty good. How about you?
I am excellent. I appreciate you coming on the program. And I appreciate this story that you wrote about this college professor who had tweeted out Sunday night, hours after this shooting at the First Baptist Church in Sutherland Springs, Texas. There is no rational alternative. The GOP and NRA must, in fact, want mass shootings. It serves their interests. And I want to, you know, I got to tell you, Adam, I want to start up front here by saying we didn't redact that. You did at Campus Reform. And I want to ask you, have you gotten any grief for not naming this professor at all.
Yes. Following the publication of this article, I always check the comments section, and people were asking me, why did you redact his name? And my personal response to that was, I felt here in my conversations with the professor, he did seem sincerely sorry, and that it was important to know that this tweet was sent out in a moment of sincere hurt, sorrow, and anger. So personally, that's why the editors decided to retract the name.
Well, I want to commend you for doing that, honestly. I don't want to criticize you for doing that. I want to commend you for doing that. Hang on, Adam. I'm sorry. I violated one of the cardinal rules of broadcasting and forgot to turn off my phone here before we started the show. So there we go. But I do want to commend you for that because, you know, look, we live in a day and age in which, A, social media's availability is ever present. And it is the easiest thing in the world. It is almost there's almost this peer pressure to go and vent your spleen, right, and deal with the consequences later. And I personally don't take any joy in seeing somebody's life ruined over a stupid thing that they said.
Exactly.
So if this professor regrets what they said, again, I don't have a problem. I commend you. But I would ask you to do me a favor. If this professor would be willing to have an actual honest-to-goodness, like not screaming match, but a real civil conversation, I would like to extend that opportunity to them through you. If they would want to come on Cam and Company, we could. I'll even keep them anonymous. We won't name them. But this guy, look, we all saw this reaction.
Yeah.
Right? A madman kills 26 people, half of them children, shoots them point blank. Yeah, you know what? All of America, I think, was in a rage Sunday night. And if we had been there in Sutherland Springs, Texas, we would have all gone and chased this guy down too. So that, I think, is actually a commonality, the anger that we all felt. What is different to me about this professor is actually the self-reflection that he showed in thinking about it. Okay, you know what? I actually don't think every NRA member wants a mass murder. I actually don't think these people, because I haven't seen that sort of self-reflection from, you know, Joy Reid or Will Wheaton or any of the other, you know, celebrities that have been venting their spleen over the past couple of days.
Yeah, no, I've totally seen on social media people like Joy Reid venting about this, saying all these people are responsible and not apologizing for their comments and how extremely divisive they are to this country, ultimately.
Yeah, so this professor, when you reached out to him, he said, upon reflection, now that my emotions have cooled somewhat, I do not actually believe the GOP or NRA wants mass shootings. He said, I do believe, however, that gun control is a losing issue for Democrats, and opposition to gun control tends to be a winning issue for the Republicans. So although the GOP and NRA most certainly do not want mass shootings, they welcome the gun control debate because it energizes their base and helps with fundraising. So that's what I meant when I said that it was in their interest. Now, I got to tell you, I disagree with the professor there, too. But I think, again, it's possible to have a civil conversation about, you know, who actually raises funds off of events like this. And you also asked the professor, like, how does this does his political views extend into the classroom?
Yeah, and he said that no, they do not, and obviously I can't verify that. But in most cases, these professors' political views do not extend into the classroom. But their social media is ultimately a reflection of who they are as a person. So it is deeply concerning when you have professors saying these things on social media, and knowing that they're teaching the next generation of this country.
It is concerning. And as the professor said, you know, he said it's very difficult to know what the right thing is to do on social media. He said the default mode for Twitter discourse is vitriolic anger, and I fall into that mode myself sometimes. Twitter, especially because of the 140-character limit, encourages brief snarky jibes over thoughtful analysis. He's right that social media does encourage it, and that was that sort of peer pressure that I talked about earlier. You know, on the other hand, Adam, I find myself wondering, is it really that difficult to know what the right thing to do is on Twitter? Because to me, it seems like the right thing to do on Twitter would be the right thing to do when you're interacting with somebody face-to-face.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that the line stops here. I think that obviously what this person said was deeply, again, divisive. And I think of course express your opinion on Twitter as much as you want to, but saying that others want mass shootings is a little bit ridiculous to me.
Well, it is. And again, I understand that was the knee-jerk response from the professor, and I'm glad that the professor has reconsidered. Did he take down the tweet, or is it still up, Adam?
You know, actually, as of right now, I'm pretty sure his Twitter is no longer up. So the entire
feed
account
is down.
Yes, exactly.
Well,
yeah.
All right. Well, that might indicate some additional self-reflection there. And if I can't control what I say, then maybe I don't need to be on this social media machine.
Exactly. I'm not sure about that. Yeah.
All right. Well, listen, Adam, I do appreciate you coming on the program. And if you talk to the professor again, please extend that invitation, because I would love to have a polite, civil conversation with this individual.
Will do. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Thank you, sir. Adam Sabas joins from Campus Reform. Now, I'm sure I'm going to get the anger messages. No, we should have outed this guy. We you know, here's the thing. This guy could be outed and, you know, complaints filed, and he could be removed from his position. But what would that accomplish if he already realizes that was a really dumb thing to say and it's not accurate? I know it's not accurate, and I was just upset. I just don't know what that serves. I really don't. Now, there was something that this professor told Adam. He said that there is perhaps no perfect response to tragedies with relevance to political debates, remarking that, quote, to say nothing seems to endorse the status quo. To attack the GOP and the NRA strikes you as divisive, said the professor. To only offer sympathy for the victims and families seems too weak a response, especially if one believes, as I do, that policy solutions could minimize future harms. Well, if that's the case, and you believe, A, that no, the NRA doesn't want mass murder. No, the GOP doesn't want mass murder. So it's not a matter of that striking anybody as divisive. That's a matter of you, the speaker, finding that actually to be incorrect and not the position that you hold. But the position that you hold is that policy solutions could minimize future harms. Well, again, maybe that would be what you would want to talk about. And that way you're not attacking half of the country. That way you're not attacking 5 million NRA members. And since that's supposedly not your intent, your intent isn't to attack people, your intent is to focus on policy solutions that can minimize future harms, you'd actually be doing that. But I don't know. I guess it's going to be hard to do if the professor has deleted his Twitter account. Hopefully, that professor, who, again, I will grant anonymity to, will join us for a conversation. Because, listen, I'm with the professor. I do think that there are policy solutions that can minimize future harms. I just don't think it's things like, quote-unquote, universal background checks or gun bans, or the laundry list of anti-gun items that Governor-elect Phil Murphy wants to implement in New Jersey, for example. I think when you look at policy solutions that can minimize future harms, well, again, we're going to talk with Jesse Jane Duff in Hour 3 about the issues with submitted records to the NICS system. We also know, again, that there are focused policy solutions that we could enact right now that don't require legislation that could reduce violent crime in our cities by 20, 30, 40, 50% in some cases. And again, it's not a gun control law that's going to do it. It's not a piece of legislation. It actually is a policy solution. It is a tactical decision to focus on those most violent offenders, as opposed to the 80 to 90 million legal gun owners across the country. All right, stick around. Hour two of Cam and Company. It's coming up after a quick break. Christopher Nyweim of the Nyweim Group, also Robert Trusinski at the Federalist. But we'll take a look at the plans that New Jersey's newly elected governor has for gun owners in the state. That's coming up right after this.
What this program will do is it will take you from somebody who has a gun and might have a gun on your hip to somebody who is proficient in using that gun.
I would say I'm still in the beginner's phase in a sense that I didn't really start doing any official training, going to classes, until about a year ago.
If I were to put it on a scale of 1 to 10 as far as proficiency, I would say I'm under 5. That will change because I have made that decision to become as proficient as possible.
With a handgun, I've got a lot more experience, and so I'm a little bit better shot. With a rifle, Caitlin is a better shot because of all the experience she has had.
I've been fortunate enough to do a lot of shooting and be in units that have done a lot of shooting. So when it comes to the legality of it, the responsibility of it, and then when it comes to the actual physical training, I think it's awesome.
I have a lot of experience with firearms, but from high-level instructors, they just have infinite knowledge, and it's really nice to learn from people like them.
You know, I've done some classes before, but these guys really break it down into every little step so that you're able to really hone in every little movement.
They all have similar backgrounds, but the diversity in each of them and the stories and experiences they've all had are ideal for someone like myself to walk into this experience.
Oh my gosh, it's definitely a once-in-a-lifetime experience getting training from these amazing guys out here. Gotten so much more out of this than a couple weeks of shooting on my own.
There's things that I've done that are fast. There's things I've done that look good. There's things I've done that work in certain scenarios. These guys are teaching a way that works every time. The heavy burden that you carry, carrying, was where I learned the most.
The rifle responsibilities is probably one of the more important parts of what you can learn.
On the range and off the range, you know, just knowing what the laws are, how we need to think, the mindset that we need if you are carrying a gun, that it is a big responsibility.
A lot of that information was eye-opening to me, and I hadn't heard it instructed that way, I hadn't heard it presented that way, so it was very educational.
You can always go to the range and shoot at paper, but this class brought in different elements that you don't always do, like low-light shooting.
Statistically, things happen mostly after dark when you would need to use your firearm, and so that's a really important skill that I need to have.
With Airsoft, it really helped wrap the whole training experience together, brought the adrenaline level up, the realness of the scenario.
I think it's the best way to learn. I think you can tell somebody something so many times, and you can look at it on paper so many times, but until you get that real tactile response and that adrenaline and that situational scenario, there's no better way to learn.
When the whistle hit and Derek started running when I pulled out my gun out of my holster and shot, you could see the distance that he got on me, and that's such a huge reality check. So as parents, this class is really great. The more tools that we have, you know, to protect our kids and our family, I think the better.
This program is great for everyone. I think it's great for someone like me that's carried a long time and had a lot of shooting experience, and I think it's great for someone that's coming in and this may be the only class they take.
America since 1949. Family owned and operated. Legendary performance.
This is Hornady. You're watching NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour 2 of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, starts right this second here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125 and more. Spending some time with Robert Trzesinski later on this hour, wondering why won't the nightmare dream of communism die? Short answer, because it's utopian, by the way, because it feeds on people's hopes and desires for a better tomorrow, even though it never really turns out to be better. Plus, Christopher Nyway of the Nyway Group, coming up here in about 20 minutes or so, says the debate over gun control in the United States needs a hard reset. Again, I'm not all that optimistic that that's going to happen, but we'll talk with Chris about what that hard reset would look like. Meanwhile, last hour, we took a look at Virginia's election results. Now, let's talk about New Jersey, where Phil Murphy won election as governor last night. He has declared that New Jersey will be a, quote, national role model for gun control. He says that this is from his campaign website, by the way. So this is directly from Phil Murphy, Murphy4NJ.com. Phil believes that sensible regulations can prevent gun violence while still preserving Second Amendment rights for law-abiding residents. Now, keep in mind that the state of New Jersey doesn't have any provision in its state constitution recognizing the right to keep and bear arms for its residents. And I don't really think the state of New Jersey has done anything to change its gun laws since the Heller decision recognized the individual right to keep and bear arms. I think there's some lip service to the idea of the Second Amendment, but we'll delve deeper into Phil Murphy's agenda when it comes to gun control. Specifically, as Governor Phil Murphy would, quote, sign common sense legislation that Christie vetoed. So what's common sense legislation? Basically, quote, every piece of gun violence prevention legislation that Governor Chris Christie has vetoed. Basically, any gun bill that Christie vetoed, Phil Murphy says, bring it back, I'll sign it. So the last go-round where Chris Christie vetoed a couple of gun bills, this was August of last year. One piece of legislation sought to more strictly define the, quote, justifiable need that residents must show to obtain a carry permit in New Jersey. New Jersey is already a may-issue state. What's your justifiable reason to want to carry a firearm? Well, I live in a bad neighborhood, and I like to be able to protect myself. Sorry, that's not a justifiable reason. That's how it goes in New Jersey right now. And apparently that's too lax for Phil Murphy. Under the bill that was vetoed by Governor Christie, the bill that Phil Murphy says, bring it back, I'll sign it, those applying for a permit would have to demonstrate, quote, the urgent necessity for self-protection as evidenced by specific threats or previous attacks which demonstrate a special danger to the applicant's life that cannot be avoided by means other than by issuance of a permit to carry. Phil Murphy says, come on, bring that back. Other piece of legislation that Christie vetoed in August of last year was a bill that would have loosened, well, I'm sorry, that's what NJ.com says. It wouldn't have loosened the state smart gun law. It would have removed the state smart gun law and replaced it with another smart gun law. So right now, the smart gun law in New Jersey passed by the legislature in 1999, I believe it was, says that when a smart gun comes to market, then after 3 years, you can only sell smart guns in the state of New Jersey. And it directs money every year to the, I believe it's the New Jersey Institute of Technology, to develop a quote-unquote smart gun. Loretta Weinberg, the sponsor of that original piece of legislation, who's still in the state Senate there in New Jersey, says, okay, you know what, we'll change this. And we'll change it so that you could still sell non-smart guns. But when a smart gun comes to market, you'll be required to carry a smart gun. You could still sell guns that weren't smart guns It wouldn't be the only thing that you'd have to sell, but you would have to sell it. Even if nobody had asked for it, you'd have to carry smart guns in your store. Phil Murphy says, we're going to bring that back. Yes, I'll sign it. He also wants to, quote, mandate gun safety training. No one, he says, should be able to purchase a firearm without first attending a gun safety training course in New Jersey. Tying in your right to keep and bear arms, again, to the availability of a range. This is one of the things that we've talked about for months now. These quote-unquote common sense gun safety advocates whose real idea of gun safety is don't own a gun. So we've been talking about the hostility to ranges opening up in New Jersey. In North Jersey, Ramsey, New Jersey, there was a range that had been proposed. The town responded by threatening to pass an ordinance that would ban the discharge of firearms within the town limits. In Wayne, New Jersey, an old Fuddruckers building getting turned into an indoor range. And as soon as the news got out, the zoning board had approved this unanimously. All of a sudden, you had political candidates in New Jersey running out of the woodwork, proclaiming that they would do everything that they could to shut down this range from ever opening up. So you've got a hostility to ranges opening where people can actually go and get the gun safety training that the governor wants to mandate you have before you can purchase a firearm. Do you see the problem there? Quote, promote smart gun technology. Phil Murphy in New Jersey, the governor-elect, says we must regain our position as a leader in the smart gun movement by requiring all gun retailers to carry at least one smart gun once they are commercially available. So there you go. We talked about that. Quote, keep guns out of the hands of those suffering with mental illness. New Jersey, he says, already requires background checks, but it should follow the lead of nearly half the states in the United States and require timely reporting of mental illness episodes to the National Background Check Database. As a lot of folks thought that New Jersey was already doing that. And again, with a Democratic legislature, and I don't think Christie vetoed any legislation there, but why wasn't that done if you want to do it? Strengthen regulations on, quote, gun transfers. Phil Murphy says he would make it a crime to sell guns without conducting a mandatory background check and would require individuals to register their firearms kept in the state. Now, I'm not a New Jersey resident, and I haven't been since I was about 8. I would not consider myself an expert on New Jersey gun laws. Maybe we'll get Evan Knappen on the program and talk about what the current law is in New Jersey. But I'm pretty sure that private transfers of firearms in New Jersey are not allowed now. You've got to go through a background check. Maybe there's no criminal penalty attached to that. I can't imagine that's the case. As for registering your firearms, keep in mind in New Jersey, in order for you to be a gun owner, you already have to basically register yourself with the state. You have to obtain what's called a firearms identification card, your FID. And then for every pistol that you purchase in the state of New Jersey, you have to get a specific pistol purchase permit. Now, that's not just one permit that allows you to purchase as many pistols as possible. No, no. Every time you want to purchase a pistol, you have to get a new pistol purchase permit. But apparently on top of all of that red tape, Phil Murphy wants to add even more. Quote, work with neighboring states to promote gun violence prevention. Phil Murphy says as governor, he will engage partners in neighboring states to find common ground on gun violence prevention efforts. I have a feeling that means he's going to be reaching out to the governor-elect in Virginia and saying, hey, want to cooperate on some gun control laws? Finally, quote, direct the attorney general to vigorously defend our gun laws. Murphy, the governor-elect in New Jersey, said Governor Christie has allowed the Attorney General's office to relax enforcement of our gun safety laws, including laws that prohibit illegally transporting guns into New Jersey from out of state. As governor, Phil Murphy would direct the Attorney General to vigorously defend and enforce our gun laws, rather than to act as an agent of the NRA. So in other words, Shanine Allen should be in prison. Brian Aiken, he'd be in prison. And, you know, Evan, who I think is going to join us here in just a minute, Evan could start telling you stories of clients that, frankly, we have never talked about here on Cam and Company. But this is happening all the time, where you have somebody who is a legal gun owner, let's say from Pennsylvania, who makes an innocent mistake, brings their firearm into the Garden State, pulled over for a traffic stop or something like that, but it's discovered that they have a firearm with them. What Phil Murphy is saying, on the one hand, Phil Murphy, the governor-elect, says that he believes in, quote, sensible regulations that can prevent gun violence while still preserving Second Amendment rights for law-abiding residents. And I guess if you are a law-abiding resident of another state and you make a mistake, you have no Second Amendment rights in New Jersey, according to Governor-elect Phil Murphy. And he wants you to go to prison if you bring your firearm there into the Garden State. Now, again, this is what Phil Murphy put out on his campaign website. This is what he was publicly touting and promoting. And this is what he has in store for gun owners in New Jersey. So we've got Evan Knappen with us on the program. That's amazing. Cameron, thank you for doing that. And Evan, thank you for joining us on such short notice.
My pleasure. Anytime, Cam.
I appreciate that. So we were just going through Phil Murphy's website and letting gun owners across the country and in New Jersey know what they are in for here, because Governor-elect Murphy was very vocal and blatant about his plans for additional gun control laws in New Jersey. But I did have a question. One of the things on his website, strengthen regulations on gun transfers. Quote, Phil Murphy would make it a crime to sell guns without conducting a mandatory background check and would require individuals to register firearms kept in the state. So what's the current law, Evan, regarding firearm sales in New Jersey right now?
Well, any firearm transferred to a dealer, there's a background check. There are no such thing as gun shows in New Jersey at
right.
all. So there's no gun show loophole, and there's no gun show, so-called gun show loophole, which we know is non-existent anyway. So any transfer already has not only a background check, but it's a background check done through the state police, which is a POC, a point of contact for the federal NICS system. But even before you get a background check, you first have to get a pistol purchase permit in which your entire background is checked, and an application process more intense than becoming a police officer. And if you're going to buy a long arm, you have to have a firearms ID card, which is the same process. Once you get the license and or permit, after that whole entire background process, then you get the privilege to pay another $15 to get a background check done as you make your acquisition. So you cannot be, you know, I guess getting background check thoroughly twice isn't enough for Mr. Murphy.
Apparently not. There's, you know, the third time's the charm, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess we got to keep on doing it three times.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's rather ridiculous. Now, every handgun purchased or acquired on a pistol purchase permit is a form of register, and every permit right on it says form of register. So when you acquire a handgun on a permit from a dealer or even in a private sale, it is automatically registered as part of the permit process.
Because that pistol purchase permit that you have to get is for that specific pistol. Is that right?
The permit allows you to buy one handgun within 90 days, and then New Jersey already has one gun a month. Because you know how many people are just going through New Jersey's incredibly difficult pistol purchase process and then getting pistol purchase permits that are only work for one gun per permit, and then of course papering them all those guns to themselves and then dealing them on the street, of
yeah.
course. So you realize, so New Jersey had to pass and already does have one gun a month, And I just tell folks that's New Jersey telling you to make sure you buy one gun a month. You better view it that way. But that's how it works. Yeah, it's, New Jersey is without a doubt the last state in the union that needs any more gun control.
Well, and here
there is no need for it.
And here's the most concerning thing, I think, at least from a non-resident's perspective. The last thing that Phil Murphy said on his website, he will direct the Attorney General to vigorously defend our gun laws. Governor Chris Christie, he wrote, has allowed the Attorney General's office to relax enforcement of our gun safety laws, including laws that prohibit illegally transporting guns into New Jersey from out of state. As Governor, Phil Murphy would direct the Attorney General to vigorously defend and enforce our gun laws rather than to act as an agent of the NRA. And Evan, again, I know that you have countless clients who have found themselves in this situation. They are legal gun owners by innocent mistake. They brought their firearm into New Jersey. They weren't violent criminals. They weren't committing a crime. And yet Phil Murphy wants to send them to prison for, what would that be, 7 years? Is that a seven-year felony?
No. I'll explain. Here's the problem. The problem is, of course, as you know, we need national reciprocity.
Yeah.
New Jersey does not recognize any license or permit from any other state. So an unknowing person who's a legal, law-abiding citizen that has a license, most commonly, let's say, from Pennsylvania, and they're not, you know, super gun people, but they've obeyed the law and they've done what they thought was right, and they make an assumption that their carry license is like a driver's license and would be honored by other states. And, you know, it's not that far a stretch considering that, you know, last time I checked, you don't get a police background check to get a driver's license,
mm-hmm.
but you do to get a carry license. And if any of these individuals end up in the Democratic People's Republic of New Jersey unknowingly, and they get charged with unlawful possession of a handgun, and they don't have a Jersey carry license, which is virtually impossible for an average citizen or an ordinary citizen to obtain anyway, then what they are facing is a crime of the second degree, which carries up to 10 years in state's prison. But what's even worse is not only do they become a felon where they lose their gun rights for the entire United States, but even worse, there is a minimum mandatory period of parole ineligibility of 3.5 years in state's prison. That means if they're convicted, the judge has no discretion whatsoever. It doesn't matter the person's a law-abiding person, never had a prior conviction, didn't mean to do anyone harm, was an honest mistake. Nothing matters. They must receive 3.5 years with no chance of parole in state's prison, which means they will do every single day of 3.5 years in New Jersey State's prison for a firearm that they lawfully acquired, for which they had a license from another state, and they were completely otherwise law-abiding citizens who made an honest mistake. And I have case after case, and you know, you've covered those cases,
mm-hmm.
and it's been just, it's a horror show here, and it is draconian in its effect. It ruins people, it ruins their lives, their careers, their families, destroys their gun rights, takes away their freedom. It is absolutely disgusting and frankly evil, and the gun laws as written now need to be reformed, not vigorously enforced so that more law-abiding citizens end up suffering under this horrible system.
Talking again with
Evan. And national reciprocity will cure it, Cam. That's what we need. It's the only way Jersey's ever going to get any relief is by national reciprocity.
I think that you're right, at least, you know, over the next 4 years. And you know, sadly, Evan, I know that we're going to be talking about more of your cases here over the next few years. And, you know, it has been a matter in the past. Now, one question I do want to ask you, because, like, he says, I'll direct the Attorney General to vigorously defend our gun laws. In some cases, you're going to be dealing with local prosecutors. I know in the Shanine Allen case, for example, you're dealing with the prosecutor there in Atlantic County. When would the Attorney General come into play versus, you know, the local DAs?
Normally, it's the county prosecutors that will handle prosecutions, although the attorney general does have statewide jurisdiction. They normally don't end up involved directly in these cases. They're handled at a county level. And so the attorney general, though, can direct the county prosecutors to do certain things. And they may, you know, file a directive that counters the Shanine Allen directive, which we fought long and hard for, in which individuals that fall into the situation we just described could actually get a diversionary program called PTI, where they are diverted out of the system and they do a period of supervisory treatment and the charges are dismissed. They don't end up with a criminal record and they don't end up going to state's prison. It was the only escape valve. And at the time, it wasn't allowed. The attorney general under Governor Christie's administration made it possible. And then at the time, just as an example, when Shanine Allen broke that glass ceiling and made it happen, the attorney general reported that 100 pending cases right at that time, 100 pending cases were helped by that directive. So that can indicate the number of people that are going to be destroyed if they go back, if they step backwards to the old days.
Evan, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program again on such short notice, and let's talk again very soon, okay?
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah,
Take care. Thank you, sir.
Evan Knappen, a Second Amendment attorney, might want to keep his number on speed dial if you're going to be driving through the Garden State, and for goodness sakes, make sure you don't have your range bag with you. Make sure, you know, no ammo rolling around your vehicle. Because one round might mean 3.5 years there in New Jersey. All right, when we come back, Christopher Nywame joins us of the Nywame Group. He says the debate over gun control in the United States, it needs a hard reset. So what would that look like? Well, we'll talk about it right after this quick timeout. Stick around. There's more Cam and Company on the way.
Speaking with Morgan Shields with the NRA Office of General Counsel. Morgan, welcome to the program. I'm excited to talk about the Civil Rights Defense Fund Youth Essay Contest. You guys do a lot of great work over there in Civil Rights Defense Fund and the Office of General Counsel. I love what you do. So when I saw the opportunity to talk about this, I wanted to schedule an interview to talk about this. So tell us, what is a Youth Essay Contest?
So the Youth Essay Contest is something the Civil Rights Defense Fund hosts every year, and it's for students from 12th grade to younger, and it gives students the opportunity to really reflect and think about how the Second Amendment affects them and what they think about the Second Amendment.
And why did you guys figure that it was important to do this?
Right. So part of the Civil Rights Defense Fund's mission is to promote education and scholarship on the Second Amendment. And part of the way we do that is by getting students and young adults to start thinking about that and producing these essays and give them the chance to enter this contest.
That's a great idea to get them thinking at that age about the Second Amendment. And who can qualify for this? What are the age ranges in the grades?
So there's two categories. There's a senior category, which is basically high school students, so 9th grade to 12th grade. And then there's a junior category, which is 8th grade and younger. So if you can write an essay, you can enter.
And when is the deadline for this, Morgan?
The deadline is December 31st. It used to be December 1st, but we've extended the deadline to December 31st to give students the opportunity over Christmas break when they're not in school to sit down and enter the contest.
Great idea. Morgan Shields, Office of General Counsel, the Civil Rights Defense Fund Youth Essay Contest. How do we get more information?
So you can go to the CRDF's website, which is nradefensefund.org, or you can call the Office of General Counsel at 703-267-1250.
I'm here with Bill Baer with Baer Arms Custom Holsters. Bill, welcome to the program. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great.
All right, tell me, what is Baer Arms?
Well, we're an indoor gun range. We're a training facility, and we're a gun store back in Ashland, Kentucky. But we also make custom Kydex holsters where we can print any logo, any design, anything you can imagine on a custom Kydex holster. And we do that all in 2 to 3 days before it's shipped out. So that's kind of a first and only in the industry. We're really quick. We employ veterans. I'm a veteran. I served in the United States Air Force during Desert Storm. I served in the U.S. Army, and we employ all veterans. I'm also a retired police officer. I served 22 years, so I know what it is to carry. So when we design holsters, we know what we need to put into it.
Well, thank you for your service. So tell me a little bit about the range first, then we'll look at some of these holsters.
Yeah, we got a 12-lane indoor gun range in Ashland, Kentucky. We offer all sorts of training, from basic firearms training to CCDW. We also do advanced training, like for law enforcement, for military personnel, or just the civilian that would like to learn some advanced training. We actually have canine training, which is kind of unique in a gun range. So we offer all types of protection, whether it's handgun or with canines.
So show me a holster here.
Yeah. Grab one. These are our custom Kydex holsters. Like I said, we can print anything you want on one. If you wanted to put your kids' pictures on one, we can put one on there. Anything, you can choose from all kinds of different types of backs. It's kind of needed. We're the only one I know, I'm aware of, that can do that, and we allow you to design your own. So you can do it. It's kind of a holster that meets your personality.
Cool. How do we get more information about Bear Arms?
Go to BearArmsHolsters.com. That's B-A-R-E, holsters.com.
Welcome back to Cam and Company here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125. We've got the Robert Trusinski coming up here in about 15 minutes. Next hour, Jesse Jane Duff with the London Center for Policy Research. Talking about a story at Stars and Stripes, the Pentagon is known for at least two decades about failures to give military criminal history information to the FBI, including the type of information that the Air Force did not report about the killer in Sutherland Springs, Texas, who had assaulted his wife and stepson while in the Air Force. But rather than talk about that, right, we certainly have a lot of folks who are saying, well, no, we need to talk about gun bans, universal background checks, ending the Second Amendment. If you want to go that far, no shortage of op-eds there. Well, our next guest, Christopher Nyewame of the Nyewame Group, a U.S. veteran, says that this entire debate needs a hard reset. Christopher, thank you for coming on the program today.
Great to be back with you, Kim.
I appreciate you joining us. Now, when you talk about a hard reset, what makes you say that? Obviously, you know, we go through the same arguments on a daily basis. I mean, I've been doing Cam and Company for 13 years now, going on 14 years. And I can tell you that, you know, the conversations and the debates and the arguments are largely the same as they were 13 years ago, even though our violent crime rate, frankly, is less than what it was 13 years ago. The argument doesn't ever really seem to change. So what would be involved in a hard reset in the debate over gun control?
Well, the first thing that would need to take place is people would need to stop with the bombastic, over-the-top, ridiculous commentary that somehow a lawmaker or a political party or individual is somehow responsible for a murder if they do not pass a policy that is, you know, tangentially expected to stop these things. That needs to stop. And a lot of these people, we have to be honest, are just political people that are out there that want to get the shock value. I get that. But we've really got to stop and take a step back. In my view, and what I wrote about in this recent op-ed, because I work on Second Amendment policy here and there, but I haven't been as involved as I've been lately because I've just been getting completely pulled into this and really bothered by what I'm seeing. The left and the gun control crowd, they just cannot accept the fact that there will always be the opportunity for gun crime. That will never stop from now till the end of time, the same way we cannot stop other types of tragedies, despite very, very small statistical significance when you actually step back and look at a comparison to opioid overdoses, alcoholism, all these other things. But understandably so, we see these shootings, they're in the media, we're all going to react to them. So first and foremost, they have to accept the fact that those particular incidences will take place. And like you mentioned, Cam, for goodness sakes, this was a gun control failure. This was a gun control failure. This did not have to do with the gun crime piece. It had to do with a gun control measure that didn't work. So that's really the second thing they need to be looking at. And so that's sort of my initial assessment on the overall environment we're looking at here.
You know, and look, I mean, as you say this, Christopher, I'm just thinking that, you know, you're talking facts, you're talking figures. Your piece at Sky News about this is it's very rational and it's very reasonable. And it is not what we had talked about last hour. We had Adam Sabas from Campus Reform on talking about a college professor who had tweeted out and now regrets tweeting out on Sunday night that the GOP and the NRA, quote, want mass shootings. And that's exactly what you talked about, that sort of bombastic rhetoric, right? And this wasn't a politician, wasn't a pundit. It was a visceral reaction from a non-gun owner and a guy who probably consumes most of his or her gun news. I don't even know if it's a guy or a female professor, but someone who consumes most of their firearms-related news from an anti-Second Amendment perspective. And that was sort of their gut reaction, right? When the news broke about this attack and the fact that there were 26 people killed, well, darn it, you know, this wouldn't happen if it weren't for the GOP and the NRA who just want this because they can make money off of it. Upon reflection, that professor said, okay, you know what? I don't actually think that. I don't think that anybody wants these sorts of attacks. I was frustrated and I'm angry. Here's what I want those gun control advocates to understand too, that no matter where you stand on the gun control issue, when a guy walks into a church in a small town in Texas and starts aiming point blank at little kids, or when a guy takes to a hotel room 30 stories above a country music festival and opens fire, you don't have to be a non-gun owner to be angry about that. We're all angry about that. That's the common ground that we have, is that anger and that heartache. The differences come when we try to talk about, okay, so what do we do to minimize the risks of this happening again? And I think you're right. You're not going to be able to stop every crime out there. We could ban cars tomorrow. And you know what? ISIS could still figure out a way to engage in vehicular homicide, like what we saw in New York last week. But it is about mitigating violent crime. It's about mitigating these specific types of active shooting scenarios or mitigating the type of terrorism that we saw in the streets of New York. And in order to do that, that's where I think you've got to make that shift from the emotional arguments to actually looking at things critically. What will work? What won't work? What is constitutional? What is not constitutional? And one of the things that you focus on in this piece that I absolutely agree with, how do you implement these proposed laws that you want to put on the books? What is it going to look like to actually enforce these things that you say we need?
Absolutely, Cam, and I appreciate you promoting it, and I hope folks will take a read, others, the NRA, because the second piece is exactly what we just discussed and what you just mentioned, which is, Once an attack begins, the fact is you've really only got three particular ways to go: escape if it's feasible, or wound the shooter, or kill the shooter. It's that simple. And if you have a firearm, your chances of survival are much, much stronger. And that's just a fact. So, you know, and the left can say what they want to do on that, but there absolutely has to be that reaction. And so I really believe that when I say a reset, it's almost to the benefit of the gun control advocates, because I believe the best way to come together on this is to understand we need to look at expanding concealed carry, understanding how to be safe, figuring out early childhood education, mental health, all those other things. And I believe that the gun control folks should look at gun buyback programs in cooperation at community level, because I can tell you, in some of these high crime areas like Chicago and others, if you can institute a gun buyback program where perhaps you've got some illegal weapons out there and you can provide $5,000 for these particular weapons, I guarantee you, providing that economic incentive to actually put an investment into those communities and get some of those firearms in those problematic areas, that might be something kind of worth looking at. But this debate cannot continue to begin with these bombastic ideas that if you don't have Senator Chris Murphy pounding his fist on the desk, or Senator Durbin saying, if you don't write this ink on this piece of paper, you know, the ink isn't working. The ink doesn't work. And the fact is, as long as there are firearms, as long as there is alcohol, as long as there are vehicles, you know, humans are fragile, and so we all need to look at this and look at what we can do, but it needs to start from a rational, constitutional, fact-based perspective, because that professor probably means well, you know, but they're just getting so lost in their emotions that they're not proposing policies that are going to help. So I think that the article was something worth writing. I hope folks will take a look at it, because I really think a hard reset could make the debate, frankly, more constructive and allow us to protect ourselves and do so in a way where the measures we do have out there actually work, as opposed to failing and then blaming, innocent citizens that want to have the right to bear arms. So it's hopefully it's thought provoking, and I appreciate you having me on and talking about this.
Absolutely. Today. Well, listen, it provoked a couple of thoughts in me. I will be honest with you, Chris. I don't know how likely a hard reset in this debate is going to be, but I would encourage folks on both sides of this issue. I'd actually read what you wrote. We've tweeted it out at Cam and Company. And folks can follow Chris on Twitter as well, at Chris Nieweem, N-E-I-W-E-E-M. Chris, thank you again for coming on the program, sir. I hope we get to do this again soon.
Yeah, Cam, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Christopher Nieweem of the Nieweem Group with us on the program. Now, the one thing I'll say here before we take a timeout, because I know we've got to talk with Robert Trzynski of the Federalist. When it comes to, Chris mentioned, $5,000 for gun buybacks. If I was going to see a local government, let's say city of Chicago or city of Baltimore, all right, we're going to give $5,000 to a violence prevention effort. It would not be a quote unquote buyback or a compensated confiscation program, because I've not seen any study that has indicated that any of these programs do anything to bring down violent crime, accidental shootings, suicide. They just don't. What I would do, if I were in charge of doling out $5,000 grants from cities across the country, is I would work with guys like Kevin Dixie or Maj Touray in actually bringing in firearms education into these areas where you don't have it, because you don't have any ranges, because you've declared for decades that gun ownership is taboo or illegal. And so as a result, you don't have. You may have individuals who are owning firearms legally without a lot of firearms training. You may have people who are owning firearms illegally. Okay? They may not all be violent criminals. They may own firearms illegally for self-defense. Now, we can talk again about what, if any, of the punishment should be for that, if these are otherwise folks who would be able to possess a firearm were it not for the gun control laws in their city. But get beyond that. Do we want those individuals who, like it or not, have a firearm in their possession, do we want them to know the basics of gun safety? Do we want them to know how to be safe and responsible? Do we want them to know how to make that transition to become a legal gun owner? I do. I do. Because I think bad things happen when guns are taboo. And you can't get that knowledge. You can't get that instruction. You can't get that ability to legally own firearms. I don't think it stops people from owning guns. Does stop people from getting education, does stop people from being responsible. But there are groups around the country that are actually going into places that are not well served by their cities. There are no ranges or a limited number of ranges, probably out in the burbs somewhere, and they are bringing that information to these high crime areas. But it's not just about the gun, and it's not just about gun ownership. You've got career counselors that are a part of this. You've got mental health counselors that are a part of this. You've got drug counselors that are a part of this as well. It all plays a role into what's driving the violent crime. And those individuals can play a role in reducing violent crime as well. So that's what I do with the $5,000 local grant that, unfortunately, I do not have to give out at the moment. All right, when we come back, we'll talk with Robert Trzynski of the Federalist. Top of the hour, hero of the day, deal of the day, and good guys. So stick around. There's more Cam and Company coming up right after this.
I'm here at the NRA National Sporting Arms Museum at Bass Pro Shops in Springfield, Missouri, with Jim Sapega, director of the NRA Museums. Jim, I was able to get out here, and I'm so happy I'm here at this wonderful museum to do a special series of Curator's Corners here. And, Jim, I thought after the first one we did, you couldn't step it up, but my word, you've stepped it up here. So not only we have this beautiful firearm,
and an impressive cartridge there. And what's this?
This came off of an elephant. It's a tusk, obviously, taken legally. As you know, big game hunters in Africa basically fund the conservation movement in Africa of the endangered species there. And the fees that they pay are what go to the anti-poaching and the conservation and the restoration efforts in Africa. So this was a legitimately harvested tusk.
It's now here at the museum.
It's here at the museum.
Awesome.
And this gun, it would be an elephant gun. It's for the heaviest African game, right. The Big Five. And it also has an elephant theme. It's beautifully engraved by Philippe Griffney, one of the greatest engravers who ever lived. And all over the gun is decorated with elephants. If you take a look, there are elephants everywhere, different species of elephants, and just beautiful, very, very deep, hand-carved, hand-cut engraving. And Griffney was especially good at that deep relief, the very, very deeply cut, raised, three-dimensional engraving. So you've got the elephants all over this gun. And it is a Holland & Holland.
Yeah, you told me, Jim, before we went on air, we had a Holland & Holland, and immediately there's a cachet. Tell folks why I was so impressed when I heard we were going to have a Holland & Holland.
Well, there are very few British makers that arguably make the finest firearms ever made. A lot of them started in the 19th century and continued into the 20th century. And Holland & Holland, along with firms like Purdy and Boss, are right at the very, very top of the finest guns ever made in terms of fit, finish, and decoration. And, of course, the great double guns, the double shotguns and the double rifles like this for African game are the finest guns.
So this is a double rifle.
It is a double rifle, and it is chambered for this round.
And that is quite a round.
This is a
Tell us about that round.
This is a 700 Nitro Express.
Wow.
Which means that bullet is 0.7 inches in diameter, just like a 45 is 0.45 inches in diameter. And I've got my handy-dandy ballistic cheat sheet with me. You measure the power of cartridges in muzzle energy, the foot-pounds at the muzzle. So when you're shooting a .22, you've got 150 foot-pounds, right? 44 mag's pretty powerful. You got 1,000 foot-pounds with a .44
okay,
Magnum.
That's a big jump up.
U.S. military rifle, the .223, right. 5.56, about 1,325 okay. foot-pounds. .30-06, a standard big game rifle in North America, 2,800 foot-pounds.
Wow.
A lot of energy at the muzzle. 700 Nitro Express, 8,900 foot-pounds.
Wow.
About 3 to 4 times the power of a .30-06,
wow.
pushing that huge 700 grain bullet.
My, oh my. So that has a lot to do with the stopping power for big game, but also just, I've got to tell you, just not only is it a beautiful gun, the workmanship, but it's got to be a well-made gun to be handling
oh, yeah.
that kind
yeah.
of muzzle velocity.
Absolutely. Extremely well-made gun and a very, very powerful gun, one of the more powerful cartridges that can be fired from a shoulder arm.
So when was this gun about? What era is it from?
This is probably late 1980s production, so it's reasonably recently made. This gun is part of the Robert E. Peterson collection. Oh. Most of that is on display at our museum in Fairfax, Virginia, the National Firearms Museum.
Out here, which is great.
We brought a couple, and this is certainly one of the premier pieces in that collection that's the finest private collection that I've ever seen. And, of course, the Petersons donated it to the museum.
Beautiful.
Largest gift in the history of the NRA, an entire gallery there in Fairfax, Virginia.
And these beautiful guns.
And these beautiful guns
and
here.
And Gatling guns, too, back
Gatling
in the
guns,
museum.
Nine Gatling guns in the collection.
So we need to see that here. And how do we see it here and at the other museum?
Here is at the NRA National Sporting Arms Museum. We're at Bass Pro Shops in Springfield, Missouri. They can see it at NRA Museum.
Jim, thank you so much for another great segment of the Curator's Corner.
Welcome back to Cam and Company here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125, coming to you from the beautiful Farmville, Virginia. Is this one of those songs, Cameron, that couldn't be made today? I realize this is like a mid-90s, late-90s song, but I think this might be called out for rampant sexism now. The female of the species more deadlier than the male. I don't know that you can say something like that these days. Join us on the program right now, Robert Trzynski from The Federalist, author of the piece, Why Won't the Nightmare Dream of Communism Die? Robert, how are you, sir?
Yes, me on again.
Absolutely. I appreciate you joining us. And, you know, really timely. I know this was the 100th anniversary of the beginning of the Russian Revolution, but, you know, also last night in Virginia, we elected a quote, democratic socialist, Robert, I think for the first time in our state's history. So here you go, 100 years after the start of the Russian Revolution. Yeah, why hasn't the utopian dream of communism died like so many communist nations have?
You know, it's amazing because, you know, the Nazis killed about 6 or 12 million people just in the Holocaust alone. And you think that sort of killed off fascism and the appeal of fascism and made it deadly and radioactive for, you know, and with good reason for, you know, ever since. But the communists killed many times that many, and that still hasn't made the dream of communism or the dream of socialism untouchable the way that you think it would be for a doctrine that had produced such horrific results. You know, I think the dream is that there are several widely accepted notions of morality that communism seems to offer, the idea of we're going to take this to its full extent, to its full extreme. And the idea that it's more good and moral to sacrifice yourself for the good of others. That's the first idea. The second idea is that the private interest should be made secondary, should be subordinated, should be sacrificed to the public good. The thing is that communism takes that and takes it to its full extreme. It's reductio ad absurdum, and shows the reasons why we should question those as moral ideals, because it shows that when you have the idea of the individual should be sacrificed for the good of society, well, you end up with a system that ends up sacrificing individuals on a very large scale, mm-hmm. Ends up sacrificing everything about the individual.
Well, Robert, we kind of lost you there for a second, if you don't mind repeating that.
Yeah. Oh, it ends up sacrificing a lot of things about the individual. It ends up sacrificing the freedom of the individual, ends up sacrificing the creativity of the individual, ends up sacrificing the dignity of the individual with the cruelty and indifference of the methods used by the communists, and ends up sacrificing their very lives. And you get this idea that, the old communist saying was, you can't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs. But what they meant by eggs was by breaking human skulls, by killing individual people. And once you have this idea that it's okay to sacrifice one individual for the good of society, you end up sacrificing a lot of individuals. And there ends up being no logic why you can't kill people on a large scale, as long as you claim you're doing it for the greater good of society in the long run.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting too, because you talk about how the New York Times has been celebrating the 100 years of communism, and you say it seems to be the only word for it, with a series of gauzy retrospectives about the idealism, sense of purpose, optimism, intellectuality, and the downright sexiness of life under communism.
Each of those descriptions, there's a link to go with it.
It's amazing what they've been producing here. But, you know, in a little bit of irony, it was the New York Times correspondent Walter Taranty who actually came up with that phrase of, you can't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs, to describe what Stalin was doing. That was not a phrase that came from Stalin. That was a phrase that came from the Western press. And so when you talk about this recent poll showing a majority of millennials prefer socialism or communism to capitalism, I think among the youth, certainly, you would find a greater acceptance for these sort of utopian and idealistic solutions of communism and socialism, not just in this generation, but, back when Robert Durante or Walter Durante was actually reporting for The New York Times in the 20s and 30s, that was the base of the communist movement here in the United States back then, too. It has always sort of been not entirely a youth movement, but one that I think works very well with the idealism of youth.
Well, I think what it works with is the ignorance of youth, unfortunately, which is ignorance of human nature, ignorance of the way the world works, but also specifically historical ignorance that unfortunately has been allowed to happen in the modern world, which is, I think what's happened really is it's been enough time since the fall of the Soviet Union
mm-hmm.
that intellectuals think they can get away with mentioning only the glossy, hazy, nice-sounding parts about the history of communism, without having to mention the poverty and the destructiveness of the economic system and all the number of people killed in the gulags without having to emphasize that. They can de-emphasize that, put it in the background, make it a little aside that's buried two-thirds of the way through the article while they talk up, while they emphasize all the things that were supposedly good. And it's because, but again, it's because there's a certain moral allure to it. There's an idea that this was a moral system, a system based on idealism and on trying to achieve good moral ends that allows people to say, well, therefore, you know, we should really try it again. And it's okay then to downplay the bad parts and to pretend that, well, maybe they weren't so bad, or maybe we could do it right this time. And we could, you know, they actually have one of the proposals of this New York Times series is about how we could try communism again, but this time without the gulags. and so it's this wish fulfillment that comes from the fact that people really want it to be true. They want it to work. They want it not to lead to the results that it actually leads to.
Yeah, unfortunately, you're right. I mean, communism without the gulag, that sounds great, I suppose. sounds better than
right
communism
now.
With the gulag, except, you know, but I mean, like, this is one of those common arguments you see, Robert, right? Like, well, it's not that communism has failed, it's that it's never really been tried. It's never really been implemented anywhere.
Yeah, this is something that, in logic, this was identified a number of decades ago as the no true Scotsman argument. So it's the idea that, you know, if you say no Scotsman would have sugar on his porridge. Well, my uncle Hamish has sugar on his porridge. Aye, then he must be no true Scotsman. It's this thing where you redefine your argument every time so that whatever counterexample somebody comes up with, it's not really an example of the thing you're talking about. And so it's a logical sort of fallacy. This is the no true socialism argument. Every time you come up with an example of a socialist system or a communist system that has failed, somebody says, oh, that wasn't really communism. It wasn't really socialism. And they'll turn on a dime to do it, too. That right now, the big example is Venezuela, which was this socialist utopia, according to people on the left as recently as 5 or 10 years ago. They were hailing it as a socialist utopia, as a model for America. And now, of course, they're starving in the streets. They're being shot by government thugs. It's all the things we should expect from communism and socialism after having tried it so many times over the 100 years. But again, you know, then the same people who said, oh, this is a great example of socialism now say, no, it's not really socialism.
Yeah.
So again, it's that wish fulfillment of trying to come up with any excuse not to have to acknowledge that there's something wrong with this. And it's not just that it's something wrong in the implementation, but there's something wrong in the basic theory.
Absolutely. Now, my response to that always, by the way, is, okay, so if all of these other folks have attempted this throughout the years and have always failed, what makes you think you're going to be the successful one? To me, that's really not a great argument anyway. Well, all these other people did it and they just failed. But I worked at GameStop for 3 years. I know how to build civilizations.
Well, you know, the old phrase used to be that they talked about the Soviet experiment. And they talked about scientific socialism. Well, in science, if you experiment with something and you conduct the experiment dozens of times under totally different conditions in different countries at different times, different leaders, and you get the same result every single time, I think that's a pretty definitive scientific result. So I think that's, you know, so much for this idea that, we haven't tried it the right time, the right way yet.
Yeah. Unfortunately, Robert, you know, sometimes these lessons, it's hard to learn from books, you know, and that's kind of what worries me is that, as you say, we've got a generation that has grown up since the fall of the Cold War. They don't necessarily understand what communism really is. I mean, when you look at these poll results, I'm not saying we're going to turn into the USSA anytime soon, but are you worried about an ideological drift in this nation towards a more socialist outlook?
Well, I am absolutely worried about that, and I think you're starting to see this attempt to rehabilitate communism, the increased popularity among young people, the fact that the Democratic Party is trying to talk themselves into the idea that if they just go farther to the left, farther towards socialism, that's their answer. And then, you know, the problem with Hillary Clinton is she wasn't far enough towards socialism. So there is definitely that leftward drift. And I would also say, you know, the problem, too, is that you have a certain faction on the right that's trying to say, well, nationalism is the answer to socialism. which I think is, you know, is not a constructive answer either. I just think there's a whole set of ideological lessons of the last century that ought to have been learned, but were never learned. I really think what we need to have is we need to have for communism what we had for fascism and for Nazism, that when you were in school, you had to read about the Holocaust, you know, and you had all these movies that came out about the horrors of the Holocaust, you know, Schindler's List and that sort of thing. And it became sort of a normal part of an upbringing of an American that you learned about what goes wrong when you have fascism and what kind of goes wrong when you have a guy like Hitler and preaching those doctrines. We've had this sort of double standard where you don't get the same treatment for communism. And I think we need to have the same thing for communism. Everybody needs to read about, you know, Robert Conquest's Harvest of Sorrow, about the artificial famine in Ukraine. Everybody should read Solzhenitsyn about the Gulag and the Gulag Archipelago. There's plenty of material out there. It's just that this is not considered, it should be part of a normal education that everybody thoroughly knows what goes wrong under communism and how badly it went wrong and in how many places it went wrong, so that they're not that this sort of gauzy idea that, oh, this is a great theory and it's going to work out and we'll try it the right way this time.
Yeah.
That doesn't sink in.
Robert, listen, that music means we got to run, unfortunately. I appreciate you coming on the program. It's good talking with you, and we'll do this again soon.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Robert Trusinski of the Federalist Hour 3 of Cam & Company is coming up next. So stick around. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Speaking with Dirk Grohl with NRA Store, it's the holiday season coming upon us. Let's talk about some great new stuff from NRAStore.com. What do we have for Christmas?
Well, as you said, it's the holiday season, and this first product is our limited edition holiday mug. That mug is specially made for the NRA, and we've only made 400 of those this year, and we're about halfway through. It's handmade in the USA, hand-thrown on a pottery wheel, and then it's hand-glazed with a beautiful rich red glaze. And we have a special ornament that's attached, and it has Santa and his reindeer. And on the bottom, we have NRA Limited Edition.
There's the first item on my list for Christmas, Dirk. Thank you. That's great.
Yeah.
So that's the
very
mug.
Popular.
What else do we have Christmas-wise? I think, what do we have, an ornament?
Our 2017 ornament. This is limited to 1,000 copies, and we're down to around 600 right now, so there's still some left.
Right.
But it's Santa's sleigh this year. That's the theme, with some greenery. It says National Rifle Association with a lot of gifts, but the most important gift in there is a rifle.
So for Christmas specifically, we have the mug and the ornament. So, but there's other new items, and you and I were talking a little before we got on the air here, and you got some really neat stuff. So show us that unique challenge coin that you have.
We made a unique challenge coin, something we've never seen before. This one is solid bronze. It's 39 millimeters. It's made in the USA. But the people that make these for us, they make these, and then they take them outside with a .223 AR-15, and they shoot a hole in them, and then they burnish the edges so you can tell all your friends, this is the size hole that a .223 makes.
So they actually, Dirk, take those out and shoot a hole in them.
It's actually shot with an actual rifle, and those little rough edges that are there, they buff those so they don't tear your pants pocket. But it's really cool, and it's $19.95.
Dude, that's a great idea. I love that. All right, what else do we have?
We have a new pistol safe. It has the NRA. Let me turn it around so you can see it. It has the NRA logo on it, and as you can see, it is just about the right size for a full-size 1911. But this is really cool, and it's different than other pistol safes because, as you can see, it does have a push-button operation. 1,500 possible combinations, but we call it the EMP-proof pistol vault because it doesn't require any batteries, no electricity, and you can just program in any of one of those 1,500 possible four-digit combinations, and you're set if there's ever a denial of service or a power outage or, you know, some kind of catastrophic event.
Anything. So you want to put your fully non-battery powered device. Don't put your smart gun in there, but your actual revolver or your handgun in there, and it's totally accessible, and nothing's going to keep you from getting your firearm if you need it. I love that.
Exactly, and it's got a handle on it, and you can take it with you anywhere you want to go.
That's nice. Yeah. Portable, too. An EMP-proof gun safe. I love it. And what else? I think we have one more new item. Tell us about that, Dirk.
You know when you go to the range and you're shooting away, and it's a hot day, and all of a sudden you think, you know what I forgot? I forgot to bring bottles of water. Well, we've solved that problem with this new concealed carry cooler. This cooler will hold 12 canned beverages, and it's a really good cooler. We actually tested this. Our team took ice cubes and filled this up, and we closed it up, and 36 hours later, we still had ice cubes.
Wow.
So we know it works great. Don't forget that it has a holster and mag pouches that come with it.
Oh, it's
really nice item.
Dirk Grove, NRAstore.com. That's where you get all the info. Love the stuff. Get over there and do your holiday shopping. Thanks, Dirk, for being on the program. We'll talk to you soon.
You're watching NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour three of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, starts right this second here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125. Also, don't forget, you can check us out on iTunes, iHeartRadio as well. Coming up here in about 20 minutes or so, Jesse Jane Duff is going to join us from the London Center for Policy Research. So we learned earlier this week that the Air Force apparently should have submitted the criminal history of the killer in Sutherland Springs, Texas, to the federal government. He was a prohibited person, but the Air Force did not do this. Well, now Stars and Stripes reporting that this is not a one-off. This is not an aberration. And in fact, for 20 years, the military may not have been reporting these records that should have been reported. The Pentagon now investigating this. You've got members of Congress who are demanding answers. And we'll talk about it again with Jesse Jane Duff coming here in about 20 minutes or so. Stephen Cruiser from PJ Media is going to join us later on in the hour as well. But right now, let's get to today's hero of the day, our deal of the day. Good guy as well. Matter of fact, I should say heroes of the day, brought to you by Adcor Defense. First, a story from Minneapolis-St. Paul, and I've got to thank, I don't know the real name, but I've got to thank Fresh Fish. Yeah, thanks, Fresh, for sending me this story from St. Paul, Minneapolis. An attempted robbery thwarted because the victim was a concealed carry holder. St. Paul police investigating a shooting that injured one person, according to St. Paul police spokesman Steve Linders. Happened in St. Paul November 7th, just before 8 p.m., police said that the would-be robbery victim was a concealed carry permit holder and shot the would-be robber. Fresh Fish had said this could also be a deal of the day because, as it turns out, the Minneapolis Star Tribune says that the suspect in this case has a criminal history in Minnesota that includes convictions for robbery, drugs, and disorderly conduct. There were three individuals in the car who were the attempted victims of the robbery. Police said the driver holds a government-issued permit to carry a firearm. The police spokesman said police are withholding his identity, quote, due to safety concerns. So they're concerned about potential retaliation here. The driver did tell police that the suspect had approached his car, pointed a handgun at the people in the vehicle. Driver then produced a handgun, shot and struck the man standing outside. He said, police said, by the way, that the person who was shot was known to one of the people in the car there. But the driver, again, acting in self-defense, not expected to face any charges. We'll look for more details on that story as it becomes available. Meanwhile, St. Louis, Missouri, KMOV Channel 4, with another armed robbery victim who turned out to be armed themselves. This in Old North St. Louis at a BP gas station. This was last Thursday around 6:45 in the evening. Victim had gone up to the gas station window. So this was one of those gas stations where you don't go inside the store. They just got a little kiosk and you deal with your business outside. He was buying something from inside that kiosk. Suspect tried to grab, I guess when he pulled out his wallet, suspect saw that the individual was carrying a concealed firearm legally. Suspect then tried to grab the gun, but the would-be victim had a secondary firearm, pulled that firearm. Suspect fired shots. Victim then returned fire, wounding the suspect. Suspects then drove to a hospital. Authorities say they were conscious and breathing when they arrived. Apparently another suspect got out of a car. He also was hit. One suspect shot in the leg, the other shot in the stomach. Victim was shot in the shoulder. He called police. Victim was conscious and breathing when taken to a hospital. The clerk there at the gas station was not hurt. And again, looks like the victim of this robbery acting in self-defense there against two armed attackers. And our last hero of the day from WSAZ. With the this is from Huntington, West Virginia, Logan County, West Virginia. Attempted home invasion there in Logan County. Three people trying to break into a home. Two of the three ended up being shot by the homeowner. Happened in the early morning hours of Saturday in Logan County. Hakeem Norman, Cody Tomblin, and Kareem Wyke have all been arrested, charged with the crime. Norman and Tomblin were shot during the alleged break-in. Non-life-threatening injuries. They are currently in the Southwestern Regional Jail, charged with nighttime burglary, unlawful assault, as well as conspiracy. Hakeem Norman also charged with malicious wounding. WSAZ reports that the preliminary investigation shows the homeowner acting in self-defense will not be facing any charges there, defending himself and perhaps his family against three home invaders there in West Virginia. So there you go. Three heroes of the day for you today. Just one deal. Fox 12, Oregon. Portland, Oregon. The man accused of cornering two women on elevators in Portland and sexually assaulting them was in court on Monday. 38-year-old Jeffrey Lane is facing charges including first-degree sex abuse, kidnapping, attempted sex abuse, and coercion. He was arrested over the weekend after officials released surveillance video from one of these elevators and asked for the public's help in tracking him down. They say over the last 3 weeks, Lane cornered two women in two different elevators there in downtown Portland, threatened to sexually assault the women, grabbed one of the women. And one of this individual's victims, woman who just wanted to be known as Marie, told Fox 12 in Portland, Oregon, quote, "I was hopeful that that's what was going on, that they had caught him. I am absolutely relieved." She says it was October 18th when Lane threatened her in an office building elevator, but she managed to get away. A couple days later, she said she saw him again on the street, called out for help while holding on to a taser. She said, "I'm loud, so you know, I let him know, hey, I'm on the phone with the police." He said, "You again, are you following me?" And he started walking towards me. She said, as soon as he saw that I was on the phone with police and saw the taser, he ran past me. In the second incident back on October 25th, court documents state that Lane followed a woman into a parking lot elevator, sexually assaulted her, and threatened to kill her multiple times before he saw a security guard and ran away. Now, KPTV in Portland, Oregon, says that Lane, who's 38 years of age, has a lengthy criminal history, including 27 felony convictions. 27 felony convictions. He's 38 years old. And he's out on the streets. Well, he was. Now he's in the Multnomah County Jail on $277,000 bail. Maybe the 28th and the 29th strike will be what puts this guy behind bars. He is due back in court November 15th. We'll keep our eyes on that story. But 27 strikes and still not out. Today's a deal of the day. Jeffrey Lane there in Portland, Oregon. Our good guy of the day today. I've got two for you. I couldn't decide. First, from Rochester, Minnesota. CBS affiliate there in the Twin Cities. An 84-year-old man there in Rochester went out hunting this week. It was Saturday, and his wife got a little worried. He had left about 3:45 Saturday afternoon. Hours go by, gets dark out, and he doesn't come home. Found his truck stuck in the mud, but he wasn't there. So authorities called out. They start their search. Weather wasn't great. Sun had already gone down. Couldn't fly the search helicopter because of the weather conditions. Dave Thompson with the Rochester Police Department said that the 84-year-old had some health issues. He had fallen before. They were concerned that maybe he had fallen down, and he was sort of, it would be very hard to see visually. He said, we were concerned that within a couple of hours it was going to turn from a rescue into a recovery. So Officer Thompson and Officer Ray Caban thought, okay, we got this new drone. Let's try the drone. About 9 months ago, the Rochester police got a drone with infrared capabilities. It can fly in low visibility. Officer Caban says it basically picks up any heat deviations, any degrees that's different from whatever else is around it. Searched for about an hour. They got a couple of false alarms, but then they found this hunter, 84 years of age. Thompson said he was actually down on the ground in a wet, swampy area, so he was partially submerged. He became stuck in a foot of mud, semi-conscious when the first responders got to him, taken to a hospital, and is expected to make a full recovery. Thanks to these officers and their technological assistance there. So, Officer Thompson, Officer Caban there in Rochester, Minnesota, we thank you for being some of the many, many good guys out there. Now, your second good guy of the day, WJTV in Mississippi, Ridgeland, Mississippi. Sergeant Jason Rudd is a police officer in Ridgeland, and he was online, came across an article about a retired Jackson, Mississippi police officer named David Scott. Rudd said the article said that Officer Scott had had a stroke and had to retire early, and that put him in some financial hardships. The officer said if he didn't pay his mortgage by a certain date, his house would be foreclosed. So Jason Rudd, who had never met Officer David Scott, didn't know him, just read about him, wrote a post on Facebook, asked people for donations to help David Scott, got about $1,000, which was enough to make the next mortgage payment and keep David Scott in his home. Rudd, Officer Rudd said, it's just a human thing. I was taught to always help my brother when I can. The Jackson Police Officers Foundation, accepting additional donations, by the way, to help keep the retired Jackson police officer, David Scott, in his home. But down there in Ridgeland, Mississippi, Sergeant Jason Rudd with the Ridgeland Police, we thank you, sir, for being one of the many, many good guys out there. All right, still to come on the program, Jesse Jane Duff will be with us. This story just gets worse. You know, the news again breaking earlier this week that the killer in the church attack in Sutherland Springs, Texas, was a prohibited person, should not have been allowed to purchase a firearm, but because the records were never submitted by the Air Force to the appropriate authorities, there were no flags on the NICS check. Now, again, the Stars and Stripes reporting that apparently this has been going on not just for a few years, but for 20 years. And now the Pentagon is investigating. Even, by the way, as you've got lawmakers who are introducing legislation to, quote, prevent anyone convicted of domestic violence, be it in criminal or military court, from buying a gun. Which, by the way, is already federal law. But that's not stopping lawmakers from trying to make it federal law again, I guess. Because, again, that's what lawmakers do. When lawmakers here do something, they say, well, we make laws, so that's what we must do. We must make a law. And clearly when you're looking at, I always want to remind legislators that there are other functions. Oversight, for example, right, is also a legislative function. And when you're looking here at the failures to actually follow the current existing law, and now the acknowledgement by the Pentagon, according to Stars and Stripes, that this is a known issue, and it's an issue that goes back decades, I'm not sure that replicating existing federal law is going to do much. It seems to me like maybe we got to get to the bottom of where that breakdown has been within the armed forces. So we will do that, try to do that anyway, with our friend Jesse Jane Duff coming up here in just a couple of minutes. Stephen Cruiser of PJ Media will join us on the program as well. And we have more of the day's top Second Amendment news and information for you coming up throughout the hour. So stick around. We will be right back with more Cam and Company right after this. We're talking with Vince Abrams, the senior marketing manager at Taurus USA, about the Taurus Spectrum. I got to tell you, Vince, this is a cool little gun.
Yes, it is. The Taurus Spectrum is the newest item to the Taurus line of products. It's 380, semi-automatic, double action only. What we did is we looked at some of the things that people didn't like in a Micro 380, and it really came down to ergonomics. So we did a number of different ergonomic studies to come up with the shape. If you notice, there are no hard edges onto the Taurus Spectrum. We also use a soft material, overmold material, that helps absorb some of the recoil. It comes with two magazines, six and an extended seven round. With the extended seven round mag, it gives room for the hand to go onto the firearm, place for the pinky to be pressed. It also corresponds with natural point of aim. Some of the other features that we have, as you rack the slide, the striker has zero energy applied to it, so it's sitting in a complete static state. Energy is applied only when pressing the trigger.
Okay.
The third unique feature here is takedown. Usually with strikers, we're used to having to press the trigger before going through the takedown process. Here, all we require is a dime. We place it in, quarter turn, and that's takedown. To put back together, we slide onto the rails, and it's back together.
That is amazing. All right, Taurus Spectrum, it is available now, right?
Shipping next month.
Shipping, okay, so shipping this fall, retail price under $300, and you can find out more information at TaurusUSA.com. All right. Thank you so much for spending some time with us, Vince.
Oh, thank you for your time.
My mission in life is to set a new standard by educating, training, and equipping my fellow warriors and citizens to become assets to themselves, their families, and this country. This mindset has led me on a path to become a self-protection expert, and I'm excited to share some of my knowledge with you guys. On this season of Noir, I'll be showcasing some of the best in self-defense, and I'll be showing my techniques in super slow motion. Over the next few months, NRA TV will be releasing a constant stream of interviews, scenarios, and techniques in slow motion. Get ready, guys, because this is going to be a whole new way for you to engage and become an asset.
It is the dream of the animal rights fanatics to suppress your most natural connection to the earth, to sell you a life filled with urban fascinations, to ignore that death is life's unwavering partner, together creating a relationship between predator and prey that makes it possible for us all to survive. To the hunter, this world's most honest steward, these fantasies are the poisonous, perverted manipulations of social misfits who would take this planet hostage. They should startle you and awaken you to trust the hunter in your blood.
Welcome back to Cam and Company here on NRA TV, SiriusXM and Patriot 125. Your first source for Second Amendment news and information coming to you once again from beautiful Farmville, Virginia. Where it's actually kind of cold and gray today, but it's still awfully pretty. We've already got our Christmas decorations up. Big Christmas tree in the town square went up a couple days ago. Stephen Kruser of PJ Media with us in just a little bit. Right now, I want to welcome from the London Center for Policy Research, our friend Jesse Jane Dove is with us at the mothership. Jesse Jane, how are you today?
Oh, I'm doing great. It's good to hear the Christmas tree is already up. We never get enough time to celebrate, so that's fun.
I know.
It's a great season.
It went up
it's
way early, like weeks before Thanksgiving. I think it was November the 1st, maybe.
Yeah, you know, yeah. There's just not, this season is just so awesome on so many levels, and why not? Get it up, get it going, get that party rolling.
So does that mean that I can officially wear my Christmas Story t-shirt then? Is this officially the Christmas season? I'm not going to get in trouble from Jesse Jane Duff if I wear my Ralphie and his bunny suit
not
Christmas
at all.
Story
I mean,
t-shirt?
You've never, well, have you heard me criticize your wardrobe before? I don't think so. I'm actually surprised.
Overheard.
Well, I mean, yeah, I can be a little bit of a fashionista somewhat, but with you guys, you can break all the rules. It's okay. If you look a little goofy, right. I'll never criticize you. That may not be a promise I can keep, but I'll try.
All right. Well, listen, I'm glad we got the fun and frivolity out of the way because we got to talk about something really serious here.
Yeah.
You know, we learned earlier this week that the killer in Sutherland Springs, Texas, this guy who targeted a Baptist church, mm-hmm. killed 26 people, wounded 20 others.
Mm-hmm.
This guy should not have been able to pass a background check, apparently did pass a background check. And we learned it's because the Air Force had not reported what amounts to a conviction for domestic violence,
mm-hmm.
Which resulted in a bad conduct discharge. And then today, Jesse Jane, Stars and Stripes newspaper reporting that the Pentagon has known for at least two decades
since
about failures to give military criminal history to the FBI, including mm-hmm. this type of information. Now, again, the FBI has known
mm-hmm.
for at least two decades mm-hmm. about these failures.
I'm just...
Like, what is going on?
I'm annoyed. That's the least of what I can say. 1997, I've seen a lot of people saying, well, this happened under the Clinton administration. Okay, stop, put the brakes on. The Pentagon is one of the largest bureaucracies that we have. Their purpose is to, you know, defend the United States, but they're not always the best on paperwork. And I believe the stats I read was over 70% of those from the Navy had not been reported, over 70% of some of the felonies within the Air Force had not been reported, and roughly over 50% or so from the Army had not been reported of these felonies. And this is serious. This is egregious. This goes to show government bureaucracy is inept. You know, we can do all the background checks, but if the government is not holding up their end of the bargain, it's worthless. And I'm not surprised. I mean, if anybody's ever been to the Pentagon, it was nicknamed the Puzzle Palace when I was on active duty. I'm sure it's still named that. Often they call any headquarters building the Puzzle Palace. But if you've ever walked through the Pentagon and its enormity, you have quite a overwhelming sense of how large the bureaucracy really is. And when you start having layers upon layers that aren't getting things reported, I'm just not surprised. We can't even get the medical records from active duty transferred over to the VA efficiently when they come off of active duty. So why would this not surprise me? And I'm not going to throw stones at one single administration. This is a deficiency that everybody's been aware of, and it took somebody getting killed before they're now going to try to hopefully correct it.
And listen, I want to second you here. I don't think this is not something you can lay at the feet of the Clinton administration,
mm-hmm.
Or the Obama administration,
no.
Or the Bush administration. Mm-hmm. As you say, I mean, this was sort of endemic. And again, there were regular inspector general's reports that were indicating these problems, but it was a matter of these problems not ever getting addressed. They were never fixed.
Exactly. You know, this is why so many conservatives get very frustrated with more government regulation, because We're not even enforcing the regulation we already have, you know, and that is one of the ethos of being a conservative, that we feel that if people were to, if we were to simplify a lot of what we already have on the books, for example, murder is illegal, you don't need to pile on multiple layers to enforce the very thing that you started with. And there shouldn't be any question when there is a court martial of this nature, an offense of assault and abuse and brig time. How is it that these records were not transferred immediately over to the proper agency so that when he came off of active duty, there was a record of his felony? There wasn't, apparently. Or there was a disconnect. Because if we're just trying to get people to be honest on these applications, we know criminals have a problem with integrity as it is. That's why they are criminals. They're not going to check the box that they've had a felony. The form, there's no fault in the form. The fault is in the bureaucrats that run these operations and getting it reported. I'm hopeful that this is something now can be corrected to prevent further death by people who should not have had a firearm in the first place, criminals who do not belong. But hey, you know, in Virginia now, criminals are going to be able to vote. So not sure. I'm not sure what direction we're going here.
You know, but this is one of the other things. It's sort of buried in the Stars and Stripes report. I think it's like this. It's the last paragraph. That says this guy was sentenced in November of 2012 to 1 year of confinement and reduction in rank to E1. Second to last paragraph. This guy initially faced charges of domestic violence for 7 alleged incidents in 2011 and 2012. 5 were withdrawn as part of a plea agreement, including 2 involving this guy pointing a loaded gun at his wife. Yeah. We also learned from an arrest report in El Paso, Texas, that this guy had fled from a mental institution while he was under investigation and had been accused of threatening his commanding officers as well as bringing firearms onto a base without authorization. You know, one of the questions that I have, Jesse Jane, is why was this guy offered a plea bargain? I mean, we have our deal of the day segment, you know, every day, and I understand the overworked prosecutors and, you know, well, we got to take these plea deals. We don't always have witnesses here. And maybe that was the case. I don't know if there were problems with, you know, his wife reluctant to testify.
Yeah,
so I don't know the circumstances of this. But given the severity of the charges and the accusations that this guy was facing, I'm really left wondering, so why was he allowed to plead down? Why was this a bad conduct discharge and not a dishonorable discharge given the severity of the accusations leveled against this guy back in 2012.
There are very strict guidelines to get dishonorable, and he may not have met that requirement with the plea bargaining or not. I'm not a JAG, so I'm not quite sure of that. But bad conduct still pretty bad. That's why it's called bad. The fact is that the military of all standards in law should be holding the highest standard, because these people were entrusted to take care of the United States defense. These people had managed to enlist with the honor to serve this country. This isn't somebody who came from, you know, a neighborhood that is crime ridden, had, you know, it wasn't the scenario that we normally see where there are unfortunate situations for people that they just can't seem to get out of. And they've been, I guess you could say, the victim of circumstances. And often you take that in consideration. This is a guy that already got through the filters, that already enlisted, that was known, that sworn allegiance to his country. And for the Air Force or whomever at that time, the commanding officer at that time, to not go for the jugular did an injustice to the civilian society, as we can see now, because this is the most honorable thing to do. It is not a right to serve this country. It is a privilege. And when you abuse that privilege, you have now taken this veteran status and thrown it to the wind and made many of us on former veterans or veterans feel as if it's a reflection of all of us. And I can assure the American public out there that we're not running around rampant being criminals and being let off easy. More often than not, the penalties are quite harsh. Unlike in the Bergdahl case, which is still making me gasp. The fact is that more often than not, some of the very small criminal activities on the outside are considered very serious criminal activities on the inside of the United States military. So the military has a responsibility to uphold its end. These are people that you gave enough pay. This isn't a pay issue. This wasn't an issue about somebody not having a reasonable place to live. This wasn't somebody who couldn't get food. I mean, they're given everything on active duty, from medical care. I mean, whatever stresses you have on active duty should not be dealing with anything dealing with your pay, your family, or any of those other circumstances. It should be combat, or it should be dealing with the enemy coming downrange. And this man created his own demise by physically assaulting and abusing his own family members. And this, to me, just reflects that he had violent tendencies. He should have had a felony conviction. Would we have stopped him from getting a gun? We've all disputed that forever. We know criminals get them anyway. But the fact that he was able to, quote unquote, legally purchase it, which was actually illegal by the nature of him not admitting on the form he had a felony and the Air Force dropping the ball, I'm not surprised. But maybe this will clean up their act that every – I hate to see more legislation. I just feel that the military, do what you're supposed to do. You know, the society out here deserves this.
I mean, again, if this is something that they're supposed to have been doing
exactly
for 20 years
– enforce the rules.
Another piece of legislation isn't going to – yeah,
enforce,
and that's the thing.
Rules.
I mean, like, so – and you know, again, I don't know what the answer to this is, but – is there going to be an attempt to find out, okay, where's the problem here? Where's the roadblock?
Audit.
And if you're not doing this, if you're not doing your due diligence, if you're not doing the job that you're supposed to be doing, are there going to be repercussions? I mean, again, you
audit.
Talk about the military treating things very seriously. Will they treat this very seriously?
They need an audit. They need to go through all those judicial records and find every single case of a conviction that had not been reported and get it reported. I don't care if it's 10 years old. I don't care if it's 15 years old. It needs to be reported. How many other offenders are out there, abusers are out there? How many sexual offenders? How many child abusers? How many domestic violence cases have gone unreported? I mean, the stats were pretty high in the report that I read, that something over 70-some-odd percent Air Force and Navy had gone unreported, and over 50% the Army. I didn't see anything on the Marine Corps. I dare to say that the Marine Corps, just being a smaller branch of service, maybe it would have been easier to manage. But the fact of the matter is, this is a problem. And how many other cases out there have we not heard of that didn't involve death, where the military could have potentially prevented this had that person been on the radar? How many sexual offenders are out there that went to the brig and now are roaming the streets, probably offending other children out here because they didn't get on the child registry list? I mean, this is much bigger than just what happened in Texas. You're talking about registries. You're talking about people in your community that you have a right to know you're living next door to. People seem to admire veterans and feel that veterans are automatically honest and honorable just because the pure name of being a veteran and what it takes to serve. But this demonstrates that we have our garbage too, and that garbage needs to be exposed and taken out with the trash. It just simply cannot be allowed to perpetuate their criminal activity upon getting off of active duty.
Again, talking with Jesse Jane Duff from the London Center for Policy Research. Jesse, listen, we've got a couple of minutes left here. I want to ask you, before we run out of time here, we haven't talked much about President Trump's trip to Asia, but, you know, when he was in South Korea and he gave that speech sort of directed to Kim Jong-un of North Korea, did you have a chance to watch or read any of what the president said?
I've read some of it, and I felt that he actually just exhilarated the military personnel over there because too many lives were lost to defend that peninsula and ensure that the South Koreans were able to remain free. And for him to call out this dictatorship right on their front doorstep, to me, is celebratory. Many people may say that it's aggravating. I think that Kim Jong-un needs to face what he is going to, the monster that he is, needs to face the words of our president instead of us keeping this, don't say it, don't aggravate him, don't irritate him. He needs to understand that this is real. And the active duty military that is over there, the South Koreans united with our military, ready to defend that peninsula, you know, don't bring it on, because if you don't want some, don't bring it on, because we'll bring some. And it's going to be a big can of whoop-ass, and you know that.
Jesse Jane Duff, listen, I appreciate you coming in studio today. It's good talking with you. And
thank you.
Hopefully we get a chance to do this again very soon. I'll be
anytime
up next week. So maybe
anytime.
We can,
bring cocktails. And bring your big Christmas shirt with your Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer on it.
I will do it. Actually, I've got one with goats on it, if that works for you.
A Christmas flying goats. That works. Thank God I'm a country boy.
Jesse Jane Duff with the London Center for Policy Research with us here on Cam and Company. We have Stephen Cruiser of PJ Media going to be with us here in just a couple of minutes. All right, in fact, why don't we take a timeout? When we come back, we will spend some time with Stephen Cruiser of PJ Media. So stick around. We have more Cam and Company on the way right after this.
Talk with Tony Lambrea from Ultimate Training Munitions. Tony, how are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you today?
I am excellent. So what is UTM all about?
So it's Ultimate Training Munitions. We convert real firearms to training munitions, our training munitions, so shoot our stuff, so that you can practice at home, you can practice in your backyard, and you can do things that you normally wouldn't be able to do on a range.
And so, again, you talk about real firearms. You're using your personal gun, right? But you're able to do this by swapping out a couple of components.
That's correct. So, on example, the AR-15 platform, all you do is take the bolt carrier group out from the live gun. You put our bolt carrier group in. It changes from a center fire to a rim fire. And now you're shooting the training ammunition, and it's no problem. Everything cycles the same. Full function, recoil, ejection cartridge, lockback. Everything is exactly the same, but it's completely safe. The rounds are only going 375 feet per second.
Okay, so when you say that you can shoot at home, like you're talking about, like you could set something up in your basement if you've got one, right? And you could actually shoot indoors and actually train on your firearm.
That's correct. So you can train in your backyard. You can train in your basement. You can hang up a target down there. There's no noise. The decibel level is only 113. So now you're training with no hearing protection. You want to bring in a new shooter, teach somebody how to start getting introduced to the firearms, perfect way to do it.
Okay, so how expensive is this? I mean, is this out of the price range of the ordinary shooter, or is this something that's affordable for pretty much everybody?
No, it's affordable for the average shooter. I mean, it's a bolt carrier group is a couple hundred bucks. So, you know, you get the bolt carrier group and the ammunition online. Actually, we have a combined site, UTM-NRA.com. You go on the site. You order from the site, and you're good to go. Get shipped to your house, and you can shoot.
That is amazing. All right, so you've got this for the AR platform. You got this for pistols as well, right?
We do, and depending on the pistol, it's either a barrel exchange or a barrel and slide exchange. So, again, your firearm, all you do is change out the slide and barrel, and once again, live round lockout, completely safe. You're getting recoil, lock back, everything's the same, but you're practicing at the house, no noise.
That is so cool. Is this something that was modified from, you know, military and law enforcement training and then came to the civilian market?
Yeah, we've been doing military and law enforcement for about 12 years. This is just being released to the commercial market now, but it's the technology that we were using in law enforcement and military. So this opportunity, again, full function, as real as it absolutely gets, because that's what we did with the military.
And that's so important from a training perspective, because if you're training, I mean, again, you get the ability to train with your firearm, right? So, but you're also getting the feel, the heft. I mean, again, it's a real gun. It's not like you're using airsoft to try to figure out how you're going to be able to react in a self-defense situation.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. These are absolutely real guns. Your magazines, everything is exactly the same, and you're getting the full function on the gun. So it's critical. The other part of that is because you're able to train at home and you're able to train safely, you can do things, you know, draws from a holster, reload drills, 180 drills, things that you would never really be allowed to do on a live fire range. Now you can actually do that. Home defense, you know, you hang targets up in someplace inside your house, and now you're shooting right from your couch, shooting down your staircase, you know, practicing in your home what you would normally have to do if, God forbid, you had to use it.
So what is the reaction when people come out and actually try the UTM for the first time?
I think people are shocked at how real it is. You know, the sights actually move. They jump. The slide is coming back pretty aggressive. So, you know, the realism is really what it is. You know, because a lot of people have shot airsoft and other things like this. And it's just so much more realistic than anything else on the market.
And so the ammunition itself, you talked about how the gun changes, but what type of ammo are you using here?
So we're using a non-tox dual primer, custom primer. So the primer in the back cycles the gun, it creates the recoil. Then the ball comes forward, hits the forward primer, that controls the projectile and the velocity downrange. So on the pistols, it's 315, on the rifle, 375. The technology is such that it actually creates an accuracy. 20 meters, you're drilling tacks. You know, so 30 meters with the rifle, same thing. And if you look online, we have some videos where we were actually shooting steel targets 50 meters in the backyard with the rifle. So You're getting accuracy at distance. You're still able to function the firearm, and yet you have no hearing protection.
That is amazing. All right, so this is the ultimate training munitions. It really is the ultimate training munition. And again, remind folks where they can find this product.
It's on the UTM-NRA.com website, and you can order it online.
All right, again, talking with Tony Lambrea from Ultimate Training Munitions about this incredible product. Again, law enforcement, military have been using this for over a decade, but now it is available to the civilian and the consumer market. So be sure to check out Ultimate Training Munitions.
Welcome back to Cam and Company right here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot. 125 and more. On the program right now with us, we have from PJ Media, our friend Steven Cruiser. Steven, how are you, sir?
Not bad. That song's from probably the best concert I ever went to in my life, too.
Really?
I saw George Clinton open for the Commodores, like early Commodores, before they were too poppy.
Yeah?
And it may have been the single greatest live show I've ever seen in my life.
Wow. I mean, George Clinton opening up for the Commodores, that's...
Yeah.
That's
and the Commodores
amazing.
Brought it, too. I thought, I was watching George Clinton, and I don't know if it was P-Funk or Parliament Funk. I don't know which incarnation it was.
Right.
I don't remember. But, and I was thinking, like, I don't know how the Commodores are going to follow this. And they brought it.
So what year?
It was amazing.
What year would that have been, Stephen?
I believe 1980.
Wow. 1980.
Lionel Richie's like solo sappy love songs hadn't become really popular yet.
Right. Yeah.
The Commodores were still mostly just a funk band. As soon as you did that, I'm sorry, I had a flashback right away. Because I still, to this day, I think it's the greatest live show I've ever seen.
Huh. All right. Now I'll have to think about my greatest live show. You should tweet out that question later. That might actually get me back on social media. Because every time I go on right now, Steven, I can just feel myself getting dumber by the minute. As my feed scrolls, I feel brain cells just...
As long as you're not getting emotionally worked up. That's the thing that people all talk about. Like, I get so worked up, and I'm like, why? I mean, you can curate your own Twitter feed. You can just go mute people, block them, have a list of people you just like. And it's really not that hard to do. It's like take a little initiative.
I agree with you. The problem is, like, you can't. I mean, I'm looking at a tweet from USA Today right now. Hey, look at the gun used in the Texas church shooting. And they are showing an AR-15 with possible modifications to the AR-15, including, Stephen, a chainsaw bayonet. I mean, this is what USA Today is tweeting out here, that, you know, you can put a chainsaw on one of these AR-15s.
Like we do.
I've never seen anybody do.
When I get a new gun, first thing I do, attach a chainsaw.
You know, I mean, like, so that's the thing. You can curate your own feed, but I mean, there's no way to avoid the stupidity here.
Well, this is how I do it, because I have to pay attention to this every day, and I don't let it get to me, because once you've established the low bar for the media and you expect them to do stupid things like that, it doesn't, as long as you have no expectations for the media and you assume the worst from them, it's really not that hard to deal with them, because you're going, oh yeah, that's what they do. And then I go write about it, but I don't get worked up about it. And I think too many people are getting worked up about it.
That's probably a fair statement. I'm not quite sure what to do about it. And now you've got 280 characters to get worked up.
Oh, God, so. Man, that's the worst thing that's ever happened on Twitter. That'll kill it faster than anything else. Everyone I've seen using their 280 in the beta test there, I think should be cut down to 70.
Wow, I'm going to let Kurt Schlichter know that you said that, because
he's been
taking full advantage of all 280 characters.
Yeah, he's doing 279 character tweets every time. he doesn't talk that much to me when we're drinking in person. But no, I think, one of the greatest things about Twitter has always been the fact that it forces you to convey a concise thought.
Yeah.
And now it's letting people ramble a little. Now you've got these mini blog posts out. So 300 characters, that's like a little mini live blog thing. But I don't know. You know, but everybody gets – I saw everybody losing their minds over the Virginia election last night, all over the country.
Mm-hmm. You want to talk about it?
Yeah. I was like, okay, well, I don't know where everybody's been, but as you well know, Virginia's been largely because of the government employees getting richer all the time there, has been moving bluish for a long time now.
It has been.
It's been going in that direction. This is like, I mean, I'm hard pressed to get weirded out by the fact that a Democrat just was elected governor in a state where the sitting governor and the junior senator are both former DNC chairmen. So it's, you know, it's like, I don't know what surprised everybody there.
You know, I don't think Northam winning was much of a surprise for people. I think winning by 9 was a surprise. And I think really the big shocker for folks was the state legislative races. Where Republicans, you know, were close to a supermajority in the House of Delegates. And I think right now, latest tabulations has it at 50-50. So, you know, Republicans would have lost 16 seats in this election last night. And that was pretty shocking because I think even the most optimistic Democrats would have said, you know, we're looking at a pickup of maybe 6 to 10 seats. So, you know, look, it was shocking news. But I don't know how much you can draw nationally from what happened in Virginia last night.
Well, you know how that would have gone. Had it not been such a bad night for the Republicans, then the media would be saying this is no national referendum. But since
right.
the Democrats did well, then today, oh, look, Trump's America. This is the way it's going to end. So they play that game every time with these statewide elections. And I'm still – this is how much of an optimist I am even in these pessimistic times. I still believe that – the United States is a collection of individual states with very individual personalities still. I don't think because Virginia goes this way that Ohio is going to do that next year, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've traveled the country extensively throughout my entire career, and people are different all over the country. I don't think that everybody votes like that.
I don't think so either. And listen, I mean, I think a huge part of this was you saw a surge in turnout in Northern Virginia, particularly, you know, the closer you got to Washington, D.C. But you also even saw some of these exurb counties that had been, you know, fairly purplish. They went blue in a big way last night. I mean, they were able to drive out turnout. And I think that was the quote unquote hashtag resistance. Right. That was the I'm going to vote against Trump, not necessarily I'm going to vote against Ed Gillespie. And then I think on the Republican side, what you saw was complacency. Like, I don't think it was apathy, but there was almost this sense of, well, you know, we got 66 seats. And one of the storylines of Virginia is that, you know, the only reason Republicans have this majority that they had is because of the gerrymandered districts and it's the fix is in. So you may have even had some Republicans say, hey, you know what, the fix is in. You know, like, these seats are safe. And by the way, that argument's been blown apart, right? That this partisan gerrymandering rigged the legislature for the Republicans. It's hard to make that argument after the election results last night. I think it was complacency on the Republican side, mixed in with a chance to vote against the president of all things. I mean, this was almost a year to the day after President Trump won. You still have a lot of angry individuals who've been protesting, you know, in Northern Virginia, in D.C. on like a weekly basis. And this was their opportunity to turn out and cast another vote against Donald Trump, even though he wasn't on the ballot. And you're right. I don't know. Look, will that translate to L.A.? Will that translate to San Francisco? Yeah, probably. Will that translate to Ohio? Will it translate to Michigan or Wisconsin or Pennsylvania? I don't think so. I mean, my bigger concern for those states would be, what are Republicans doing? What are conservatives doing to give voters a reason to vote for them?
And what are they doing to get out the vote, which has always been a bugaboo for the Republican Party? They've never been as good at that as the Democrats are. They've started to make strides in recent years, but it's still not an overwhelming, relentless obsession with get out the vote on Election Day for Republicans, and it kind of is with the Democrats.
Yeah, and particularly, well, I mean, like, not only that, but, like, early voting. We don't even technically have early voting in Virginia. You have to fill out an affidavit stating why you won't be around to vote on Election Day. But we had record high numbers of people who were filling out those affidavits saying, for whatever reason, I can't go vote on Election Day. Most of those, I think, were in Northern Virginia. Most of those would have been votes for Ralph Northam. And you know, part of that, too, I don't know, Stephen, if it's a difference between that you know, that sort of, and I realize I'm engaging in gross generalizations here, but the collectivist nature of the left, broadly speaking, versus the individualist nature of the right, broadly speaking, is it simply easier to organize those who like the idea of a collective?
Oh, yeah, I think you definitely have a point there. It's once you know, you're talking about like almost like a mob mentality here, but as applied to an election. And it's once everybody gets all fever pitched like that, it is kind of easy to induce them into behaving as the big groupthink blob that they often are, despite the fact that there have been a lot of fractures on the left in the last year or two.
Mm-hmm. Well, listen, I mean, there were some fractures on the left during the Virginia governor's race. You know, I mean, you had people who were angry at Ralph Northam for saying that he would sign a bill that would ban sanctuary cities if a city in Virginia tried to become a sanctuary city. And I imagine, by the way, there'll probably be some northern Virginia cities that'll put Ralph Northam to the test on that next year. You know, there were people who were saying, oh, Ralph Northam is people on the left. Ralph Northam is demonstrating his racist self. He had a couple of groups say we're no longer going to directly support Ralph Northam. At the end, though, I think a lot of progressive voters in Northern Virginia, they were willing to hold their nose, even if they thought, oh, this guy's kind of squishy and he's a sellout, because they could still view that vote as a way to vent their anger at President Trump.
Aren't these amazing times where now the Democrats are voting the way that Republicans have always voted until last year with the hold your nose kind of thing, and we're just going to take one for the team here? That used to be a Republican thing. And now it's more of a Democrat thing. I still don't know how this is going to apply to next year, because you can look at this race every which way you want right now. The Democrats still don't have much of a message for next year other than we don't like President Trump.
Mm-hmm.
That may have worked last night in a state that was already trending that way. But, you know, maybe this will scare some Republicans in other states to work harder to get people out for the Senate and House races, too. But other than that, I don't think it's a winning strategy. I've never thought it for the Republicans either. When they would tell me to vote for someone just because he was less bad than the Democrat, I'm like, okay, that's not really motivating me here. So I don't know. I really don't know where they're going for next year. I don't think this is a bellwether thing, and I don't think it means that they're a lock to have a big year next year.
I like I said, I don't think they're a lock either. I mean, we were CNN may have had a poll out showing that, you know, support for trust in Democrats at a 25-year low. Trust in Republicans, even lower than that. Trust in the media, even lower than that. I mean, like, we are a nation right now that is, I think, casting about and not happy with what we find, you know, by and large. And that's why I say one of the things that Republicans need to do is to actually go ahead and make the case for themselves, right? Don't just, and as you say, the case can't just be, well, I'm not them, right? I'm not that guy. Or, well, aren't these ideas stupid? You've got to be able to explain your position. You've got to have a position that that people will agree with, but you've got to sort of show the math, right? You can't just say, well, I'm a little bit less bad than the other people.
Yeah, during the election when I decided to leave the GOP for the first time in my adult voting life, I wrote a lengthy thing at PJ Media, and I went into detail precisely about that. I said it's not good enough for you to say the Republican is less bad anymore. You need to give me something positive to vote for. And that's all I'm asking. Give me one thing. Say one thing I like. And you get, that's how easy I became last year. Say one thing I like and you're going to get my vote. But if all you've got is, well, she's worse, he's worse, that, and that's not doing it for me anymore. That's not a platform. That's a tantrum.
Steven Cruiser with PJ Media. Speaking of tantrums, by the way, we've got like 2 minutes left. Keith Olbermann still gets invited to The View? That's amazing.
I didn't think anybody was having him on camera anymore.
I didn't either.
I was kind of stunned by that. That was like, and you know, in that video I posted, there was like Meghan McCain's shining moment thus far as the token Republican on The View, where she just said, she looked at him, she goes, you're absurd. And, you know, but yeah, Trump has been more harmful to the United States than Osama bin Laden. That's what he said, with a straight face.
I assume he said it with a straight face because he honestly believes it.
Well, you can't, you can't be right in the head if you honestly believe.
Well, I'm not a medical doctor. I can't make that evaluation, but I do think that Oberman really does believe that. I mean, like that's one of the things that I think may be hard for people on the right to understand about why there is this surge in turnout. You know, it's not just that we hear Republicans are Nazis, punch a Nazi. No. They really do. Some of them really, really do believe that Trump is worse than Hitler. They really do believe that they are fighting honest to God fascism. Like it's not an insult that they're hurling out.
Okay. I'm going to share something really quick with you. A comedian friend of mine who I've been good friends with for 25 years. In fact, we had a long convo last week where we caught up and hadn't talked in a long time. And at the end, it was like, God, I miss you. Great. Let's get together. Let's work together. And she and I haven't seen each other in a while, but it was a nice long conversation. After what happened on Sunday, she posted something on Facebook that said, okay, enough with the PC stuff. All gun owners are filthy animals who don't deserve to walk the earth. And I was like, whoa, this is one of my oldest friends, really, and now I'm a filthy animal who doesn't deserve to walk the earth. And they go beyond hyperbole with the first response most of the time now, way on the other side.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to respond to that anymore. If she'd said that to me to my face, I doubt she would have, but I think people are emboldened online, but you're right, and they do, and I do think that they all think that until they spend time pondering it. I would hope.
Well, which gets us back to maybe our original topic of less time coming up with that perfect 279 character tweet, maybe more time engaging with people face to face in the real world, having a conversation that can last 15, 20 minutes even.
Yeah, I've had some good ones lately with people from the left when you're actually just sitting there and talking and not calling everybody names because you're feeling empowered online.
It's
a really good one.
It's amazing what can happen when you're willing to actually take the opportunity to try to do it. Stephen, listen, we got to run. Unfortunately, that music means that we are out of time. But thank you so much, sir, for coming on the program. We'll do this again soon.
Have a good week.
You too, sir. In the meantime, make sure you're following Stephen on Twitter. His account, far more active than mine has been lately. Stephen Cruiser, Stephen with a PH, Cruiser with a K. We'll see you back here tomorrow, live 2 p.m. Eastern on NRA TV, midnight Eastern, 9 Pacific on Sirius XM Patriot 125.